she was like, heavy on the booze last night.
All right, good morning. The Senate Committee on Human Services and Early Childhood will come to order. It is Wednesday, December 14th. If you have a cell phone, please turn it to silent or off so that the millions of people that are watching all over the world do not have their audio disrupted. All of a sudden, that sounds like a different kind of comment. So we are going to go out of order because we have a couple of folks here that need to get to the e-board. So we'll go through that, then we'll do the work sessions, then we'll do the rest of the hearings, and then everybody gets a chance to talk about their bills if we have time. So with that, I am going to open up, and we have Representative Stark joining us from the House today because he likes us. And we are going to open up an informational meeting on local and regional systems that serve children. And we're going to invite up my new list, the Senate President and Senator Winters, Janet Carlson, Sidney Nestor, and Bill Bainey. So we'll need one extra chair.
Two. Sounds good.
Okay, I'll just stand so someone can take my seat because I got to go.
We'll get you a chair. We care about you.
Well,
they don't.
He needs a chair.
My name is Senator, District 11. Thank you, Chair Galster, Vice Chair Olson, Senator Mark Sanderson, Senator Ambrose, and Senator.
Can you put the microphone?
Senator Jeff Cruz. I have written testimony. I'm going to read some of it, but not all of it. As you know, we are working very hard to get people help, more help, and make some major investments, particularly in the areas of children and particularly in the areas of mental health. But it is apparently, and I'm going to be reluctant to say this because I'm not as versed in it as Senator Winters, Commissioner Carlson, as well as the members of this committee. There's a lack of statewide coordination among the different programs that exist in general, but in particular in the area for children. Currently, local governments in every region of Oregon, local groups, excuse me, in every region, are working collaboratively on children's issues, local groups. And these groups are called Children's Systems of Care Coordinating bodies and are required by the Oregon Health Authority to be convened through their each CCO contract. So that is going on, and I could go on about that at the local level. But presently, we do not have anything in the state level like that. And the governor has indicated, and just surprised me, I didn't know she was going to do this, that is her intent to create such a team. Now, establishing a state local body will provide a forum for the most difficult cross-jurisdictional statewide issues to surface and to be solved. It will allow the directors of each child-serving agency to collaborate, work with on a statewide policy issues. So I'm going to just now go to sort of a free statement here. My staff has worked very hard on this systems of care idea. We were going to introduce legislation, and then they came and said, we don't need legislation, Peter. I said, thank you. We can do it through executive order by the governor. Okay. Now I find out that, well, we don't need that necessarily. Maybe the governor can do it. I don't know what we need. So I don't know what we need. Does anybody understand that? I do not know it. Now, Senator may know what we need. Janet Carlson may know what we need, but I don't know what we need. But if we need a bill, or we need an executive order, or we need budget, we should do this, I believe. And I think you can have, and I have this great little chart. I was going to hand it out with the children, all these programs that local communities have now, and they have, they're working it with all these. We don't have anything like the state. But if I hand out this chart, I can't explain a lot of it. So I'll look really worse than I do right now, you understand. But I know that this chart accurately reflects what Commissioner Carlson is doing in Marin County. She is the overall seer of this. And the idea is to take this and put it at the state level, which would help not only the locals, but also help all of us. So I don't understand if you understand anything I just said to you. But the reason I wanted to bring it here during this time is that in case your individual collective wisdom is, you know, you do need a bill or you do need executive order, we could glean that from you. So that is why I've come here today, and why I'm joined by the esteemed state senator and the esteemed county commissioner, as well as other individuals. So that is my statement, and I hope I haven't made it more confusing than perhaps it is right now, particularly if you're trying to get services as a child, et cetera, from state agencies. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. President. And I don't think there is anybody in this room or any place in Oregon that does not recognize that whatever the details are, there is no one that's been a greater champion for improving mental health services for children and adults than you. So it means a lot when you take the time to come and talk about what we need and how to get there and to keep it front and center, even when times are tough. I think it's easy with mental health to say we'll get to it later, and that later never comes, and your urgency has helped us really try to make some progress.
I have to leave because I got a crisis in eBoard that I'm trying to deal with before eBoard is no longer on the face of the earth. So I need to leave right now, if I may, because I really would much rather be here than go down to eBoard. But I have to do that. So please do not be offended by my early exit.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jackie Winters, State Senator representing District 10, and I'm joining my esteemed Senate President this morning in support of whether we do a bill or whether it's done by executive order to address the issue of the array of services and that are out there in our communities. And the good senator is correct. Our communities are working very diligently to bring solutions to the array of services that exist for families and children. I'm going to digress a little bit and talk about what has been done in both economic development and another arena that we all have supported, and that's called regional solutions. Well, if you look at what's being asked to develop a state level here, it's similar to the work that's being done in economic development. We recognized that there are multiple agencies that are involved. And in the case of children, there are multiple agencies and services that are involved in communities. There is the need to make certain that we're bringing all those together in a system way in order to address those needs that we said that we've identified. Regional solutions, and I can only speak for Marion County because I'm the convener for Marion County, has done a tremendous work in resolving, one, some of the barriers to counties and cities and getting some of those their needs met. And I see the same kind of system as we look to children and families. We have a tendency, and if you look at the number of service agencies that have something in one way or the other to deal with or to address issues, if we're talking mental health, if we're talking education, if we're talking daycare, if we're talking foster care, if we're talking instant shelter care, the array, and I wish somebody would do a PERT chart, is very vast. The communities and that was required in our CCOs have begun to address those issues of multiple agencies that are involved in the lives of children and families to bring those together in order to provide the best services that are needed. And so I'm just here to actually echo our Senate President and said I'm on board. Whether we do it through legislation or whether we do it through the governor's executive order, and it's noted that she did the governor, I think she budgeted for this particular activity. As we create programs, I think we need to also be aware that we've got to have a vehicle for people to access that which we create. And we also have to have the ability to make certain that we are eliminating the duplication and the overlap. So to me, systems of care coordination is working at the county and the city levels, and we need to make it work at the state level. So with that, I need to join the good Senate President because we do have an eBoard crisis this morning.
All right. Thank you, Senator. And I think there is now room for Sydney and Dr. Bainey to come on up.
So good morning, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. I'm Janice Carlson, Marion County Commissioner. As President Courtney talked about, there are 16 coordinated care organizations in the state of Oregon, and each is assigned to create a system of care committee. And in Marion and Polk counties, with Willamette Valley Community Health, which is the CCO for our two counties, I am currently chairing the board of directors and then also just recently started chairing the executive committee for the system of care. This committee is comprised of people in leadership positions that are serving multiple disciplines, across multiple disciplines for children's programs. So, for example, we have the director of our juvenile department, our sheriff, DHS Child Welfare, our school superintendent of Salem-Keizer School District, mental health leaders, juvenile court judge, early learning hub director, and representatives of the Oregon Health Authority, and a number of others. I won't name them all, but you get the picture that these are folks that are involved in their own systems, but then they cross systems as well. So it's a fairly large group. So we've had three meetings so far. We have had some training on what system of care is. We've been defining the scope of our work. We have agreed that we need to identify the gaps and the barriers in the system for these kids that cross multiple systems. And we've also agreed that this can cover children, not just youth, but children 0 to 18, so young children, older adolescents, and that our work can range from prevention work to intervention and crisis types of work. There's been a subgroup that has been developing proposals to talk about how we might fill the gaps, and we've actually costed out a few of those proposals and talked about where the money might come from and how we might work together on them. That's about as far as we've gone in three meetings. So I just wanted to give you a flavor for the work of our local work. And then I want to introduce Sydney Nestor, who serves on that executive team and also has been active on the subgroup in developing the proposals, and she's going to tell you what it looks like on the ground.
Hi, thank you very much for having me here today. I'm Sydney Nestor. I'm a supervisor with Marion County Health Department. Am I close enough?
Yes, you're doing great. Thank you.
All right. Right. So I'm going to cover three things for you all real quickly. A system of care just defined really simply. I'm going to talk a little bit about wraparound and the experience of a family that lives in Marion County. And then just a little bit about the governance structure that Commissioner Carlson referenced. So system of care, in a really simple way, is a network of community-based services and supports that's developed in order to serve the needs of children who cross at least two systems in their families. It's characterized by a variety of different principles, but I think a couple of the most important are that it puts the family and the youth at the center of the decision-making process, and it recommends a service array that's culturally and linguistically a match to the needs and the culture of the family that's served. Essentially, system of care is a way of supporting children and families with complex needs in a way that's collaborative and coordinated. There are lots of different ways that system of care gets played out from community to community. And here in our region and across the state, for the last few years, we've been doing high fidelity wraparound. And wraparound is probably one of the vehicles for system of care that's most commonly associated with system of care. I want to share with you a story of a family that we've worked with in Marion County. I'm going to, for confidentiality, refer to the child as McKenna. She was 5 years old when she was referred to wraparound with her family. The family has a multi-generational history of extreme poverty. Mom is a single mom with three children who had a pretty significant substance abuse history, but was newly in recovery when the family was referred to wraparound. McKenna was significantly delayed in almost all of her developmental milestones and would become really aggressive towards her siblings and towards herself when she was frustrated and didn't have the words to use to express what was going on with her. One of the first things that we do in wraparound is we work with a family to develop the vision. And the vision is our way of really helping families start to develop some hope that there is a different future available for them than the one that they thought that they had. And so the vision that this mom had for her family was, my children will grow up in a safe and nurturing home, do well at school, be happy, and enjoy life, which is probably pretty similar to the vision that most of us have for our own children. What we know about wraparound is when it's implemented to fidelity, it's highly effective. And fidelity means that wraparound is done according to 10 core principles and really focuses on four essential elements of change. Two of the necessary elements that I wanted to share with you guys today are the development of natural supports and self-efficacy for parents. I was talking to my son about natural supports and why those are so important, and shared, if it's the middle of the night and you have really, really good news or you have really, really bad news, who are you going to call? Most of us are going to call our mother, our spouse, our best friend, our sister, but the families that we work with, typically all that they have to call are their probation officers, caseworkers, therapists, or a hotline. And so we know that in order to really raise our children in this complex world that we live in, that natural supports are needed. This mom had really alienated most of her natural supports over the course of the years. So they didn't really have anyone other than professionals to turn to when they needed help. So the team knew that a focus on natural supports was one of the most critical things to get them on the pathway to their vision that the mom had for herself and for her children. So today, this family has 5 natural supports that meet regularly and support the team. And in addition to that, she has a whole additional array of people in her life that she can reach out to. The team did this by helping mom repair some bridges that had been burned in the past, and also teaching her about reciprocity, the idea that everyone has strengths and gifts that they can bring to relationships. So many of our families don't like the feeling of always having to ask for help. So teaching them that you have something that you can bring to a relationship that you can offer to others while you're receiving yourself really goes a long way towards developing natural supports. The other thing that the team knew that we really needed to focus on for her was self-efficacy. So self-efficacy is the skills and confidence to be a change agent in your own life and the life of your children. This mom had little to zero skills or confidence in her ability to advocate for her children. And when she did try to advocate, it often resulted in feeling very threatening and aggressive. Today, mom is able to be an excellent advocate for her children. She can disagree in a way that still leads to a positive result at the end. She can ask for help when she needs it, and she recognizes the strengths that she and her family bring. She did this by building skills and really practicing that amongst the team members. McKenna is now mainstreamed in school, which is something that at the beginning the team never really thought was possible. She's receiving services, a robust array of services from intellectual and developmental disabilities, and she can use her words to talk about her feelings, and she doesn't get aggressive when she's frustrated. Finally, for this family, one of the most critical things for them is they're no longer homeless. Chronic homelessness had been a real problem for them over the years for a variety of different reasons. And last week, the family moved into their own home. So they're almost done with wraparound. They're well on their way towards achieving the vision that they had set for themselves. And they did that through working together with a collaborative team-based process that recognized the strengths of mom and the children and really helped prioritize the needs of the children and put mom at the center of the decision-making, because we know that parents are the best experts on their children and what they need. Last, I just wanted to say a little bit of something about the governance structure. So the system of care governance structure is designed in such a way that everything, barriers and challenges and problems are dealt with at the lowest level possible. So as an example, a need may arise through a team that a placement is needed for a particular child. But the team knows that the solution that they come up with at the end of the day is really not the best solution for the child. And so they know they need additional help, additional brains at the table in order to solve the problem. So they may move that issue up to what we call a practice level work group. At a practice level work group is clinical supervisor level staff across the child caring system, along with representatives of family and youth. So those are often youth and family who've been recipients of wraparound themselves or who work in wraparound programs. And at that level, they may hear from other systems like DD, who had a child who also was placed inappropriately because there wasn't the right services to meet her needs, or they may hear from a therapist about a child who spent 4 days in the emergency department because there wasn't a place for that child to go that really met their clinical needs. So that team then knows that they need to move that up to the System of Care Advisory Committee. That's, I would say, mid to higher level supervisors, again, across that entire child caring system. So that's really the group that looks at, from a regional Marion in Polk County, policy development and really tackling barriers that are systemic. So at that policy level, we determined that we really needed a multi-systemic response that was regional, that really focused on blended funding in order to meet the needs of children. Because it had funding attached to it and was going to need a lot of creativity, that issue then moves to the Executive Council, which is the one that Commissioner Carlson chairs in Marion and Polk County. And so, as she referenced, that group's been working really hard to figure out creative solutions to the problems that have really been driven from the team level up, with family and youth voice heard at every level along the way. One of the things that we've run into there is that licensing is an issue. If we do a crisis respite program of some kind, we want to be able to have juvenile department youth, developmental disability youth, child welfare youth, and children who just live in their own families who need a break, all to be able to be maintained in the same place for a very short period of time, which is a licensing issue. So that's the kind of issue that we need to be able to move up to a children's cabinet or a children's council that doesn't currently exist, because we can't address those licensing type issues, which will create a barrier here.
Thank you so much. Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bill Bainey, and I'm the Senior Manager for Direct Clinical Services for Multnomah County Mental Health and Addiction Services Division. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. As a local mental health authority, the county is committed to helping all children in Multnomah County lead happy and healthy lives. Our role is to meet children wherever they are, whatever their mental health needs might be. This can mean anything from helping prevent mental illness to connecting children to community-based treatment services and everything else in between. We believe that families need to be in the driver's seat when it comes to meeting their children's mental health needs. That's why we support the system of care model. The idea behind system of care is to create a plan of care that's community-based, guided by the family, and informed by their cultural experience. And when a child or adolescent is involved with multiple child-serving agencies, we bring them to the table as partners in the family's treatment. We use a governance framework to ensure we're serving families as effectively as possible. Framework includes key partners and stakeholders such as juvenile justice, mental health, educators, early childhood, youth and family representatives, culturally specific providers, child welfare, developmental disabilities, primary care providers, and community-based providers. Members of our governance structure provide input as subject matter experts and use their input to guide our services and supports. Our governance framework is a major asset to the system of care. Our stakeholders have worked together to overcome major challenges to our services for children. Some of the items that we've addressed include ensuring children involved with DHS have access to safe, stable shelter, providing services and supports that are culturally responsive, providing access to respite for parents of youth with severe mental health challenges, advocating for equal reimbursement for foster care caregivers, foster system caregivers, and providing cross-sector training to help stakeholders coordinate with youth-serving partners. Because these issues cross county lines, we're partnering with Clackamas and Washington counties to form a new regional executive council this year. The meetings have just begun, and we're excited to share our compliments at a future committee hearing. But some of these issues require state-level support and guidance. That's why Multnomah County recently drafted a letter to state leaders, including the governor, requesting that Oregon develop a leadership council at the state level composed of representatives from all child-serving systems. The body would address complex needs affecting children and families in Oregon. These issues would go beyond what the local and regional governance can address. Those may include state-level policy revisions to support cross-system collaboration and coordination, helping systems access flexible funding to support families' needs, and facilitating data sharing across child-serving systems. A state-level governance framework would help families in Oregon have a greater voice and choice in their care. We're also encouraged that Governor Brown has highlighted the Children's Cabinet in her latest proposed budget. This cabinet would reflect the core elements of system of care model. This is an important step towards supporting and treating children and family wellness holistically. We're thankful for the state's continued support for system of care, and we're looking forward to continuing our work with our state and metro region partners. Together, we can ensure all children in Oregon can access supports and services to help them lead happy and healthy lives. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for this panel this morning? Senator Olson.
Thank you. Anyone can answer. What is the relative size of our problem? How many children do we have? Stress.
Well, let me just take a stab at that, Chair Gelser, Senator Olson. The answer is it depends, all right? So for the respite initiative that we were talking about, there were very few number of children in Marion and Polk counties. I think we were talking about, what, a handful of children, 10, 20 children. But if you talk about how many children are in poverty or how many children are at risk, you know, there are thousands of children just in Marion and Polk counties that that meet that definition. So I think, you know, really it depends on where the group is focusing on one initiative, whether it's early learning or whether it happens to be children with very, very complex needs. So that's one of the beauties, I think, of the system of care, is that it's not just kind of limited or rigid, but it can be flexible, and you can address a lot of different needs with children.
You know, when system of care was created, and actually how it's been implemented, it was implemented in support of high-fidelity wraparound, and that was the way it was originally set out. And I think having a model of high-fidelity wraparound is a very targeted and population of focus that you can work around. But what it's done is really illuminated some of the systemic institutional structures and barriers that have to be either adapted or evolving to really better meet this population. In a fully developed, fully matured system of care, it's not exclusive to mental health. It was never intended to be. So I think your question is, who else could be served by this population, by this structure? It could be early childhood. It could be K through 12. It could be folks that are in the juvenile justice system. It's really around all child and family serving systems. I think this is where the magic happens, is when they actually work in an integrated, coordinated way to kind of maximize the resources and actually work more effectively in complementing each other, as opposed to being more categorical in their system approach.
So in terms of the children's cabinet and all of the different systems that kids live in, one of the concerns that I've heard recently is that there are an increased number of dependency petitions being filed by the juvenile department, not necessarily related to abuse or neglect, but related to reoffense and the capacity of families to support kids not to reoffend, but that unintentionally puts additional pressure on the child welfare system that isn't necessarily built out to be a juvenile justice system. Is that children's cabinet, is that a place where those multiple agencies could look at how decisions in one division might be impacting another?
So I'll take a step. So I think the magic at the process that you work at the local level, if it can be addressed at the local level, absolutely. And I think this is where the collaboration can happen at the local level. And if you have the authority, and the process is, make a decision based on the authority that you have. Locally and regionally, you can. But oftentimes, that's a state-level decision. And some of the collaboration and some of the systemic barriers that has to be addressed at the state level. So absolutely. That is, without question, an issue that could be addressed with the Children's Cabinet.
Thank you. Any further questions?
Yeah, I'm going to follow up, if you don't mind.
No, of course.
For Multnomah, Washington, Clackamas County, what's the impact of the children? How many are there?
For all three counties?
Well, whatever your group covers.
For the population of focus that we have for the wraparound project, we have approximately 250 children that we're focused in on, high acuity kids. So these are children that, with wraparound, it's typically 5% of the population use up 95% of the resources. And what they're looking at is, how do you really be more proactive for that population? And again, that's a very scripted, very targeted population that can really identify where those other challenges are. As we've been working, we've found that a lot of the other issues that we're addressing through this process have centered around DHS placement. And I think DHS has been a really key partner in sharing some of the challenges they're having and how we can partner with them. It's not that it's a DHS issue. It's our collective community-based issue. We've got to figure out how to do it collectively. So answering your question, our population just for this project is 250 for that tri-county area. But we've just grown over the last year to serve much larger than just 250.
Can I add, in Marion County, we serve at any given time about 220 children in wraparound, ages about 2 to 18. And the need that we have far exceeds our current capacity. Juvenile department and primary care are two of the systems that right now are really pushing at our door for expansion and support to system of care and wraparound.
And Senator Dimbro, you get the last question of the morning for this panel.
Thank you, Chair. I would expect that Marion County and Multnomah County are kind of in the forefront of pursuing this wraparound model. How capable are other counties in the state going to be to pursue this model, and how do we address that disparity?
There is wraparound, I think, now in finally every CCO across the state of Oregon, and it's developmental. There's definitely developmental kind of process here that happens. We've been doing high fidelity and wraparound in Marion and Polk County since 2006, so longer than anyone else anywhere in the state. Some CCOs have just been doing it for a year or less. But the nice thing that the state has built into is really a structure of support and technical assistance so that CCOs and counties aren't doing this work on their own, but they've created a learning collaborative where we're able to share with one another what's worked, what hasn't worked. They're able to receive technical assistance and training and really training and improving their workforce. So it's a process. I mean, we'll never be to the end of it because we're constantly trying to improve, and the CCOs in the early stages have a long way to go. But I think everyone's committed, and there is an infrastructure that exists to support it.
And Madam Chair, if I could just tag on to that, in terms of the governance structure, Senator Winters talked about regional solutions as being a model for what this children's cabinet might do. And I think one of the big gifts that regional solutions brings are those people that work, the staff that work in each of the different regions that can bring ODOT and economic development and all the different state agencies to the table. And if you've got a problem, you can just lay it out and you can dig through it. And that's our vision for how it could work with the Children's Cabinet. If you had folks that could then reach down into the regions and help, that would kind of make it more equitable across the 36 counties.
Thank you all very much. Really appreciate your coming. All right, we're going to close the informational meeting on local and regional systems that serve children and open up a work session on the introduction of committee legislative concepts. So we go through this every year. The committees, as a matter of courtesy and formality, introduce committee bills. Voting to introduce the bill does not indicate that you like the bill, that you support the bill, that you will vote for the bill, that the bill will ever have a hearing. It just simply puts it in the system. And for those of you that have sent bills to be introduced today, as we go through the list, make sure you hear your number. And if for some reason it's missed, let us know so that we can get them in by the end of the committee. So we'll hold open the work session just in case we've missed something.
Some of these are good bills, so.
And some of them are good bills, but we will not comment on which ones they are. Senator Olson.
Chair Gelser, I move that the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills. LC 0940 dated 11-17-16. LC 1616 dated 10-19-16. LC 1833 dated 10-25-16. You might as well all kind of lean back. I've got a long list. LC 1931 dated 11-2-16. LC 2141 dated 11-2-16. LC 2163 dated 11-21-16. LC 2180 dated 11-28-16. LC 2653 dated 11-1-16. LC 2811 dated 12-5-16. LC 2918 dated 11-22-16. Can I take a short break?
No, there are no breaks.
LC 2965 dated 11-22-16. LC 2967 dated 11-22-16. LC 3039 dated 11-21-16. LC 3040 dated 12-13-16, and LC 3071 dated 12-7-16.
So, did you hear your numbers?
All of them.
Senator, did you hear your numbers, Senator Dimbrough?
I did.
Great.
Thank you.
All right, did you hear your numbers? Okay.
You did.
Bob, did you hear your number? Okay, great. All right, so Vice Chair Olson has moved the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills. We get to do the whole thing again. LC 940 dated 11-17-16. LC 1616 dated 10-19-16. LC 1833 dated 10-25-16. LC 1931 dated 11-2-16. LC 2141 dated 11-2-16. LC 2163 dated 11-21-16. LC 2180 dated 11-28-16. LC 2653 dated 11-1-16. LC 2811 dated 12-5-16. LC 2918 dated 11-22-16. LC 2965 dated 11-22-16. LC 2967 dated 11-22-16. LC 3039, dated 11-21-16, LC 3040, dated yesterday, 12-13-16, and LC 3071, dated 12-7-16. Is there any discussion?
I'm sure I'd just point out that the later we get into legislative days, the longer the list and the committees become, and I'm assuming that in judicious afternoon it's going to be massive.
I assume it is going to be massive. And so I just say this to the president's office or the chair of the Judiciary Committee or anybody else that's at 2, if the weather changes over the next couple hours, I also will keep, I'm going to hold the work session open in the event that people have quorum issues and need a place to.
Veterans is this afternoon.
Yeah, so we may be, if people leave,
I think they're talking snow at 2 or 3 at this point, aren't they?
So how long do we have to stay here?
Well, if it snows, we can have human services forever because Senator Olson loves these meetings. All right, so there was no objection? All right, if not, these concepts are introduced as committee bills, and I am going to temporarily close the work session on the introduction of committee measures.
That's a good point, though.
And then before we move on to the next DHS section, I just want to update you in terms of what is in OLIS. There are a lot of materials that are in OLIS today. Some of them we were going to have in September, but we ended up not having a meeting. The department has done a lot of work to make these materials available to us, so thank you to all of the people that have worked really hard to make that happen. And there's some people at the department that we never get to see them here, but there's a person named Helen that has worked really hard to get these and redact them and put them together. So if Helen is listening, thank you. And all the folks that we don't get to see, we know that we create a lot of work for all of you, so thank you. So what is in there are the every substantiated allegation of abuse in a child caring agency since July of this year. There's about a dozen of them. So that's anything that was substantiated, and it indicates whether it was the old definition of abuse or the new definition of abuse. There also is, and this is really important, so listen to this part carefully, and I think someone else may talk about it later. There are the logs for July through November of this notification line where all of the incident reports, abuse allegations, licensing allegations come into. In the initial set that we got, it was just that list, and when they get them, they kind of have to categorize. If this is a problem, what would the general category be? That doesn't mean it would be open. So we just got this morning at about 6:40 in the morning, which again goes to how hard the department is working to get these things together that shows what happened to those. So they got September done, and on that list, you'll note there are just over 300 calls. Less than 5 of those were referred for an investigation by a WAPI. So when you're looking at that list, don't look at that as, oh my gosh, there's all these investigations that are being opened by a WAPI. It was less than 5 out of that 300 calls. But it will give you a sense of what to look at. We also asked the department to list where those calls are coming from. If you remember, 1515 created a requirement that an employee of the department report when there's a concern about health, welfare, and safety. On all of these lists, the vast majority of calls are coming from the child caring agencies themselves, who are not mandated to send these things to the call lines. There are very few that are actually coming from department personnel. And I know those are things that people have been listening about, have been concerned about, and that the department has really worked hard, I think, to course correct some initial challenges in July and August. And you can really see that change in that September list. So with that, I think that's everything that we have in there. And then there's the letters of revocation for the programs that are currently facing revocation of their licenses, either for mandatory reasons or non-mandatory reasons. And those letters list out what the programs are and what it is that led to that licensing action. The idea being, as we're having these discussions, to really have it based in data and not anecdote. So we are going to open up an informational hearing on the safety of vulnerable populations and the safety lens that the department is applying to all of its work. And I would invite Clyde up and anybody that Clyde wants to bring with him.
Good morning, Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson. For the record, Clyde Psyche, Department of Human Services.
With me at the table is Nathan Ricks, and I've invited Nathan up because in September I talked to you about us building a unified program improvement plan for child welfare based on the governor's independent assessment and other reports that we've received over the years, and mentioned that we were going to be hiring a project manager to oversee the entire process. Again, so there's one person that we have that's accountable for making sure that this work gets done. And so Nathan has been hired as our Director of Executive Projects and wanted him to share information with you on his background and then the progress we've made to date. He's started with the department on November 28th and has done, I think, quite a bit of work since then. And I wanted him to give you an update this morning. So when the governor asked me to return to DHS in November of 2015, she made it very clear to me that one of my top priorities was the safety of the people we care for. And although at that point in time a lot of attention was being paid to child welfare, she really made it clear to me that safety was not just an issue for our child welfare population, but really for all vulnerable adults that we're responsible for. So seniors, people with physical disabilities, and people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. So that's something that has really taken the lion's share of my time since I've been back and is something as a leadership team, and you're going to be hearing from several members of the team later in the presentation as they come and speak about specific initiatives in their program areas. But it's something that we pay attention to on a daily basis. Something that's always in the front of our thinking and on top of our agendas. And it's really about us trying to renew a culture of safety in the department. Now, you know, we have 8,000 plus employees across the state. And changing the culture of a large organization is not something that can happen overnight. But it's something that we work at every day. And while we've made progress, we still have a lot of work to do. So, as you know, the bulk of our services are really provided by non-DHS staff. We have foster parents. We have adult foster homes. We have nursing facilities. We have residential care facilities. We have child caring agencies, behavioral rehabilitation services providers. And really, I would submit to you that the majority of our providers really do a very good job and really care about the people who are entrusted to their care. And kind of in a real simple way of thinking of it, I see that we have three categories of providers. So we have a top tier of providers. These are people with a proven track record who have provided great service over the years, who are leaders in the provider community. And I will say, though, that just because they're in that top tier, that doesn't mean that we still, as a department, don't have a responsibility to monitor and provide oversight to the care that they're providing. You know, it's not like, well, we don't have to worry about these people. We actually have to be diligent about every single provider in the system. And then we kind of have a middle tier of providers, and these are people who are very well-intentioned, who want to do the right thing, but need some help. They may be a new provider. They may be struggling with a particular issue at that point in time. And these are providers that we really want to try to support and work with, provide technical assistance so that they can deal with the issues they have and provide the quality service that our clients deserve. And then we, you know, quite honestly have providers who should not be providers. And it's our real responsibility to make sure that we're holding those people accountable and, when necessary, revoking a license or putting them out of business. So really, it's kind of a fine balance. It's really a balancing act. You know, we want to make sure that our clients are safe and receiving quality service. But we also want to make sure that we're being fair to providers and providing them the support they need to provide the quality service that our clients deserve. So it really comes down to what I think are three primary principles. Number one, and the top principle, is making sure that our clients are safe. And I would even go further than that, because although safety is the primary issue, I also think our responsibility is to ensure that these clients who are in care also have the highest quality of life possible. You know, you can keep someone safe, but not provide the quality of life that we're used to, and that I think all people are entitled to. So it's not just about safety for me, it's also about the quality of life and the quality of care these people are receiving. And then I think we have to be fair to providers. Fairness for me is always one of my top values, and so we want to be sure that we're treating providers fairly. And then finally, we always have to keep in mind that we need to do what's in the best interest of the clients. And so I think if we use those three principles, excuse me, I think we can get to the point where we have a fairly stable system and our clients and customers are getting the quality of care that they deserve. So I just wanted to share with you some of the things we've done since we've started down this journey in November of last year. So when I first came to the department, in looking at the organizational structure, the department was structured in a way that the policy and the operational parts of the programs have been separated. And one of the frustrating things for me is I'd go to the people on the policy side and say, who's responsible for that or why did this happen? And they'd point to the program people and say, well, you'll have to go talk to them because they're the ones, that's where the problem is. So then I go down the hall and get to our operational people and say, so tell me why this happened and what's the resolution or what are we going to do about it? And they say, they would say to me, well, that's not our issue. That's the policy people. You got to go talk to them. So after making several trips back and forth between the two offices, you know, I kind of came to the conclusion that this was a model that was not really working for the department, because I always feel that in order for it to be effective, you have to have single points of accountability. If I have a problem in child welfare, I need to go to the child welfare director and say, why did this happen and what are we doing about it and how are we going to fix it? And it's incumbent on the child welfare director to deal with that issue. Just like if there's a problem with DHS in general, and any of you want to know who's accountable, I think you should expect to come to me, and I'm that single point of accountability. And so we restructured our organizational structure and gave the authority back to the program directors. And, you know, they were very excited about it, but I warned them that's a double-edged sword, right? Because, yes, I'm giving you the responsibility and authority, but remember, if there's an issue, I'm not going to come to anybody else in your organization. I'm going to come to you and say, why are we having this problem and what are you going to do to fix it? And then it's on their shoulders to get that done. So we've also made some leadership changes in the department. And one of the changes we made was in our Office of Licensing and Regulatory Oversight and our Office of Adult Prevention and Investigations. And Dr. Richardson, when he comes up, will speak to those changes and why we made those changes and what the outcome has been. In the past, you've also heard me talk about our Licensing and Safety Review Committee. You know, this is a cross-departmental committee that meets twice a month, and in it we talk about providers or facilities that we're having concerns about, and it's a way for all the different parts of the department who have a piece of the process to get together in one room and really get on the same page and then develop kind of a unified plan on how we're going to move forward in dealing with problem providers or facilities. And our Aging and People with Disabilities program under Ashley has also established a serious incident review committee. And her and her executive team review all the serious incident, including fatalities that happen on the senior and people with disabilities side of the program. One of the major efforts we have in child welfare is called the Critical Incident Response Team. And it's the next item on the agenda, but I'm just going to kind of roll it into my presentation because it's a critical piece of safety. This was something that was established statutorily under ORS 419B, and it directs the department to, within 24 hours of the fatality of a child due to abuse and neglect, it directs me as the director to form a critical incident response team to review the case and to try to identify systemic issues, procedural issues, policy issues that may have contributed to the outcome and how we are going to improve on our process so we could prevent things like that from happening in the future. I also have the authority to convene a CERT or critical incident response team for incidents that don't actually rise to the level of definition provided in statute, but incidents where I'm concerned about it or I've seen something and I think there's something to be learned or something that could be improved in what happened in those incidents. And I think since I've been back, there's been at least two cases where after reviewing the case file, I said, we got to take a deeper dive into this and look at this because I'm really concerned about how we got to where we got to. So the CERT team is responsible for conducting a thorough review and analysis of the case and what actions we took. And then really to look at what are the systemic issues or the policy issues or procedural issues that led to the outcome. I have been very involved in the process. I've sat in on all the meetings since I've been there. I'm the final reviewer of the reports. I think there's a lot of useful information to be gleaned from those reports and information that will really help us be a better organization. So just a couple other things I want to talk about. The statute also, Senator Gelser and I have talked about this, the statute also directed the department to adopt administrative rules to guide the CERT process. One of the things I've discovered is that we have not done that. We've drafted the rules. We've drafted the rules, but they've never been adopted, which was a surprise to me. So what I'm doing is I'm going to put forth an emergency rule, and we're going to immediately start the process to adopt the final rules. And I think that's been a real gap. I don't know why we didn't adopt the final rules, and no one can seem to explain it to me, but that's something we can fix right away. So we're going to move forward on fixing that. So currently, we have three open certs, and in the case of two of them, we expect the final report to be posted by the end of the week. And in fact, one of them is on my desk right now for final review. These certs have taken longer than I think they should have, but there's a couple of different reasons for that. One, we seem to have had quite a few of them come up, and we have one staff person assigned to that. So that's something I have to look at, how we staff this, and is it reasonable for one person to carry that burden? The other issue is that in reviewing some certs that actually had already been in the final stages, Dr. Richardson at that point in time was serving as our interim child welfare director. We sat down and looked at them, and really, they didn't say anything. They had almost been written in a way or sanitized so that they really didn't say anything. And so we reopened those certs and sent them back because our expectation is that while respecting confidentiality, we want to put as much information, relevant information, as we can in those reports. And then once those reports are finalized, we post them on our website. And so at least two of the three open certs are ones that we've sent back and say, we need to rewrite these or we need to relook at these. Because I it's hard for me to explain this, but I think in the past the department had a certain view on how certs were to be written and put forth in we've let people know that what our expectation is around the way these reports should be written, and from this point forward, that's what our expectation is for staff. And then the final piece around the cert issue is that one of the issues I've struggled with in the department is kind of the accountability follow-up. You know, Senator Gelser, you know, as we did the governor's independent review, some of the things that the independent reviewer found actually were things that had been mentioned in three or four previous reports. Some of the issues that were identified are issues we've known about for 5, 6, 10 years. So as part of the cert process, recommendations are made on what we need to change. And so what we're going to do from this point forward is that as recommendations are made, the ones we're going to accept, we're actually going to assign staff by name, staff people who are responsible for following through on that. And then we're going to reconvene the group in 4 to 6 months to say, okay, so what have we done about it and what progress have we made? Because I think without that accountability piece, it's really easy for these things to kind of go by the wayside. And in fact, history has shown that's what's happened to them. So that's kind of what I had to talk to you about. You know, the bottom line, it's really, for me, a leadership issue. It's up to me and each of my program directors and my executive team to continually deliver the message that safety is our top priority and that really the culture of safety has to permeate throughout the entire organization and that we are going to hold people accountable for making sure that happens. So with that, I'll stop and maybe have Nathan go, and then we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Sure. Thank you, Nathan.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, good morning. Again, for the record, my name is Nathan Ricks, and I'm the Director of Executive Projects. I'd like to do three things this morning. First, I want to introduce myself and give you some background about who I am and how I came to be here at DHS. And second, I'd like to describe the skeleton of the plan that we have and our approach to beginning to implement the public knowledge recommendations. And then third, I want to tell you about my plan for the next 30 days and give you a place for us to continue the conversation. So again, my number one goal in this role is going to be to direct the project portfolio effort to implement the child service safety improvement plan. And the goal here is really to put children and youth first. Child welfare and child issues are very close to my heart. I began my career as a teacher in the Bronx, a special education middle school teacher, and from there obtained grad degrees in policy and educational leadership and have really been working at a systems level. The Regional Solutions Program was mentioned several times in prior panels, and I worked with the prior governor's office administration on getting that program canonized in statute. So looking at this broad-based systems, looking where there are disconnects between operations and policy is where I hope to be able to bring my skills and effort to continue the work that Director Psyche and the leadership team have started. Over the past 2 years, I worked with the Oregon Liquor Control Commission in setting up the regulatory structure and business guidelines for recreational marijuana. And I'm proud to say that there we had tremendous success in convening large groups of stakeholders to build rules that worked for everyone, build licensing protocols that were able to leverage our existing liquor licensing expertise while also training and developing staff in a way that we're able to blend skills and really add new knowledge where there previously was none. Additionally, we were able to capture numerous efficiencies and bring maximum revenue in for the state in working with the new industry. So again, my goal here really is to put youth and families at the center of DHS business processes, per the recommendations from the public knowledge report. And what this is going to require is some extensive and dedicated analysis of the data that we already have. We have numerous reports that have come in over the years. We have certs that, going back 10 years, that haven't really been analyzed for patterns of things gone wrong, but have been reflected, I think, very straightforwardly in the public knowledge report. So now it's really about making sure that all of the elements of feedback are included in the plan, and then that there's project work backing up each one of those improvement efforts. What that process will look like will be that we take the goals really that we've already started to set through the public knowledge report, namely safe and swift response to allegations of abuse and safe and appropriate placements, and setting timelines to those, creating metrics around those so we can measure how we're going to be successful. A river without banks is a swamp, and I'm a strong believer in making sure that we have very clear boundaries so that all of the project work can move forward in a work stream so that we don't get lost, sidetracked, or overloaded ourselves with doing this improvement work that we've set forth for ourselves. Like I said, the priority is going to be given to both of the two recommendations in the public knowledge report, but I'm convinced that there are many other projects that we will need to do alongside that to complete our work. At this point, we have probably 15 or so discrete work streams, plus or minus a few, and when that plan's finalized, that will be put up on our website, and we welcome your feedback in the creation phase here. I'm happy to share early drafts with you, and also our community partners, caretakers, and other stakeholders we've already begun to engage. In terms of governance, we'll be partnering with the steering team to help guide the work, and I'd be happy to talk about more of that in detail as we form the plan, but at the very least, we want to make sure that we have Foster Youth alumnus that can give their voice to this redesign effort. We want to have child caring agency representatives, member from existing committees, such as the House Bill 4080 committee that's starting up. We want to have cross-agency representation, such as the Oregon Youth Authority and the Oregon Health Authority. We want to have members from the field that are actually doing the casework on the ground across Oregon's very diverse geographic regions. We want to have tribal representation, foster care families, and more. So looking to the next 30 days, what I hope to accomplish are really three goals in order to start putting youth and families at the center of our business. The first is, like I mentioned before, taking all of the reports that we have and aligning them with what we have in the public knowledge report. So we're talking about lots and lots of hundreds of pages of information that have either been put aside, or bring them into one place and say, here are how we're going to achieve our results. Two, we want to begin to onboard project management staff to actually manage this work. We'll have assignments to each one of those individuals. They'll be responsible for setting up goals so that we can trace back to all of those reports and plans the evidence of how we're moving forward. And we want to establish the steering team within 30 days so that we have a clear governance structure that can guide the work, show us pitfalls, and contribute to this open, inclusive process. So at this point, I've really just given you a flavor or a taste of what's to come, but I look forward to integrating your input and entering into more conversation with you. So thank you.
So I had a couple of questions, and I'm sure others do too. I guess there's two that I'll ask at the same time, one for Clyde and one for Nathan, or maybe both of you. When you talked about kind of the role of the department in supporting providers, what's the balance between support of understanding new regulations or changes in expectations and expecting a provider to come with basic competency. So, for instance, if I go and I decide to build a house, I don't expect that I am then going to have to teach my builder about earthquake standards and how to dig the foundation and what type of materials to use. I'm hiring that contractor that's providing a service to me because I assume that they are professionals. Otherwise, I'd do it myself. So where is that balance, and how much responsibility appropriately rests with the department to train professional contractors to provide a professional service that you're contracting out for at public expense?
So, Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, thanks for the question. So, you know, first of all, as we go through the licensing process, there are points along that process where we evaluate the competence of the person and the fidelity of their business plan. And so, you know, it's kind of the ongoing process through licensing where we determine whether or not what the skill level is and whether the person is able to provide the kind of care they need to provide. I think once we have providers on board, we do have a responsibility, you know, to a certain extent, to provide training and technical assistance. And on a regular basis, go into facilities and say, you know, hey, you really need to look at this, and here's how you can fix this, you know, and have things we look at that don't rise to the level of endangering safety or quality of care, because once that happens, we go down a different path. We also have been talking with other provider organizations on how we can partner with them to help support efforts to provide training, whether it's online or in-person training. We're working with the Oregon Children's Alliance on really trying to establish kind of a peer mentoring, peer support network within their provider network. And so we have a responsibility, but you know, it really, to me, kind of stops at the point where we feel that the safety and quality of care is becoming an issue. And then our role changes, and it has to change.
And then kind of along with that, what is the training or outreach that's being provided to youth who are being served about what they can expect, what their basic rights are, how they can have a concern answered, or if they raise a concern and it's not answered? I know at our December hearing last year when Lois was here, the question was, what's the outreach to the kids that were at Give Us This Day? And there was consultation with psychologists. What's happened with that in terms of outreach to kids that have been abused and are still in the system?
Right.
And
Right. Are
there those kinds of ongoing trainings the way that we see those trainings for providers right now?
Yeah, Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, that's an area we really need to improve on, and there's not much, I'll be honest with you. It's one of the items on our list of issues we need to address. Nathan will be looking at that. I think when Dr. Richardson and Lena come up later, they may be able to speak with it. But we need to really strengthen that piece of it. I will be real honest with you and say we don't do a very good job now, and we need to do better.
And I think that's really part of that. I mean, I think what I took away from the public knowledge report was we had a very adult-centered system, and I think it's fantastic the engagement of the foster youth. And I guess that's the question for Nathan. When you're talking about engaging stakeholders, do you see your primary stakeholder as kids or as providers? And given that kids that are self-harming, in crisis, challenged, suicidal, and abused don't have somebody in the building that's representing them or that can regularly go to your meetings, how are you empowering and lifting up that voice so it really is a youth and family-centered system and that voice is balanced? And I think one of the places this concern comes from is, I know there was the BRS rate-setting kind of model group, and I went back and read through all those minutes. There were multiple meetings where the DHS folks and the provider folks were debating about whether a youth should be allowed to come, whether it would be too hard for the youth, whether the youth would be distracting, whether they should be allowed to vote, and they never came, and they weren't part of that of that discussion. And that's a concern when talking about stakeholders. How do we get the people we're actually serving at the center with the primary voice?
So, Chair Gelser and Vice Chair Olson, let me kind of really quickly try to address that and then turn it over to Nathan. Is really a couple things, right? One of the things that really struck me about the report we got from Public Knowledge is kind of the visual they provided, where really it was concentric circles, and in the very center was a child and the family. And I think that's what our approach needs to be. We really need to say, this is where it all starts. And then everything outside of that is really in support of getting good outcomes for the child and the family. You know, I know that we've been working on establishing actually a foster youth advisory committee. And I think Janine Beatrice, my chief of staff, was meeting some people with that. And I know Dr. Richardson has been very involved with that. But we have to find ways to not just hear from providers, but also to hear from the foster youth themselves, the families, and foster parents. I think we have not done a very good job about engaging foster parents because they're a very important part of the process. And we need them to be working with us and at the table to get the kind of results we want to get. So, Nathan, I'm sorry. But.
Sure. Chair Gelson, members of the committee. So I, yesterday, actually, with the Children's Alliance, one of the things that came up in meeting with a foster youth alumnus was that we, as DHS, in pursuing a youth and family-centered approach, need to go to youth, foster youth and alumnus, and say not just, here's our plan, do you have any heartburn, but actually convene a meaningful group of stakeholders, of which the Child's Alliance is already doing, and say, what do you see as the primary safety issues in your home, and what concerns do you have by the way you enter into the system and exit the system? So it's really a ground-up engagement effort rather than just passing along a report and saying.
Is there a conflict, though, in the providers themselves selecting the youth that are part of that? So if which the intention is good, I'm not saying mm-hmm. Children's mm-hmm. Alliance bad, but the Children's Alliance primary, I mean, it's a trade organization. Its primary yeah. responsibility is to represent the providers. So, I mean, that's why we have independent ombudspeople we're going to hear from later. It just seems like there should be a more independent avenue for youth to come up, because if their provider is inviting them to come and participate, we've heard from youth about how scary it is to raise concerns, because what if I get separated from my sibling? What if yeah. my phone privileges get taken away?
So I just wanted to put a clarification. Chair Gelser and Vice Chair Olson, the organization he was meeting with was not the Oregon Children's Alliance. It was the Oregon Foster Youth Connection.
Okay, that's very different.
Organization. So, yeah. I just wanted to make sure we were clear on which organization we've been working with.
Right. And one thing I would add, Chair Gelson, members of the commission, the BRS report that you mentioned, that's something that we are integrating fully into our report. As we build our governance structure and stakeholder group, if you have specific individuals or providers that you're interested in us considering, please, don't hesitate to send those forward. You mentioned earlier training and development of youth to the extent that we do that with providers. That's something that will be integrated into the plan. I've heard that and read it from numerous sources just in the past 2 weeks, and we realize that's a gap that needs to be filled.
Okay. And then the one other question that I had for Clyde was on the certs, and I know that the GJ cert was issued mm-hmm. yesterday. I'd urged people to read it. I had been waiting for that one. It was a constituent of mine that died in foster right. care at right. 16 of a bowel impaction, which is a pretty devastating thing. What was incredibly disturbing about that report was not what I expected to be disturbing about the report when I read it, but an entire lifetime of missed opportunities to intervene for a child who suffered tremendously. And what I took away from it, and I'm hopeful we can talk about tomorrow afternoon when we have our big three branch, and there's echoes of it in other CERT reports, but I think because of your leadership, to make it more explicit, that there were a series of what people might call small errors, or the intentions were good, but when it's a kid that's at risk, each of those errors is cumulative to the trauma that child has. And I can't help but think that for this kid, not just in her death, but what she suffered with and what her surviving sibling suffers with, we've really failed her. And I appreciated that there's the 4-month follow-up, but I'm wondering, are there immediate actions coming out of that around screening and assessment? Will there be personnel actions that are taken around really some pretty egregious failures that individually could look small,
yeah.
but really profoundly yeah. impacted this child's life?
So, Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, I think What I want to say to you is that we have chosen that one to do pretty extensive follow-up on, and we are actually outside of the CERT going to be initiating a program review kind of around that case in the area where that happened. So.
Thank you. Other questions? Senator Montes Anderson.
Thank you for being here. During my campaigns, always I knock on a lot of doors, and it's amazing how many providers I actually knocked and actually had great conversations with. And so, of course, with the passage of Senate Bill 1515, there was a lot of input that I was getting from providers. Now, I'm not talking with the clients that they have living in their homes. Mm-hmm. And there was some fear with some say now DHS has taken on a policing role, and here I'm opening up my home and I come to really care and actually love these people that we're giving care. And some were saying that they were thinking of maybe even closing because of the changes that are being made. So what I like you said that there needs to be a balance. Mm-hmm. I really would like to know how many providers are closing their homes now, and is this going to be, and why, and maybe having exit interviews to mm-hmm. see why are you not wanting to provide services.
Right.
And then, and so I just wanted to make that comment. And then, and I don't remember, it must have been an email I received, that there was a suicide in a home, and investigators came in and got and sent all of the caregivers that were in that facility mm-hmm. away because they... And so, evidently, that isn't maybe best practice for trauma crisis. And I would hope that when situations like this happen, that the investigators that are going in are trained in how to handle trauma crisis.
Yeah. Sure.
Intervention.
Yeah.
Because within 2 weeks or sometime afterwards, there were two more attempted suicides.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if it was due to the turmoil and
yeah.
the caregivers that they are seeing. So those were just, you know, I'm concerned that we don't want to have the good ones go away because of the
yeah.
policing
sure.
is actually
sure.
the term they use
yeah. Yeah.
that DHS has taken on. And I relate to that because as a public health nurse, I had to follow up with a failure to thrive child that was returned to the home. It was in the foster care system. And they were always afraid, I could sense it, of me going into the home because they were so afraid that I would find something wrong and that then their child, it was a 9-month-old boy, would be taken away.
Yeah.
They were doing great care, so that
sure.
never happened. But
sure.
So I just wanted to give yeah. that perspective from
yeah.
the provider's point of view.
So Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, and Senator Montes Anderson. So just a couple of things I want to say. So I know there's a lot of concern from providers about the implementation of Senate Bill 1515. But to be honest with you, a lot of the actions that we were taking would have been taken with or without Senate Bill 15. It's authority we already have and things we already would have been done. And to me, when I looked at it, there are some things probably in the bill that we could tweak, and we've been working with Senator Gelser, and she's been great to work on. But the primary issue for us, and I'll be the first to admit it, is not so much in the bill itself, but the way we implemented the bill. And we have been working very hard to remedy that. And Dr. Richardson, when he comes up, because he's in charge of our licensing and investigation functions within the department, will kind of speak to that. And I also want to be very clear that the bill really impacts child caring agencies, so the adult foster homes, in residential care facilities and some of the in-home care on the senior side are not really part of or under the authority of the bill.
Or child foster homes.
Yeah.
Either.
So I just want to be put on the record and be really clear about that. And, you know, we made some mistakes in the way we chose to implement the bill and some of the interpretations we made. And we have to own that, and we have to fix that.
Thank you. Any other questions? Cindy Olson.
I hate to open this can of worms, but I've heard a lot about this particular problem, and it goes to the fact that those people that are providing the care aren't adequately funded.
Yeah.
How are we going to resolve that issue?
So, Chair Gelser and Vice Chair Olson, that really is a problem. You know, unfortunately, over the years, we've either made decisions not to invest in the infrastructure around the child care services system or all our other systems either. We've chosen not to invest and in some cases have really actually cut funding. So the governor, in putting forward her budget, did propose increases for our behavioral rehabilitation services providers, foster parents, which we probably haven't given foster parents a rate increase in 10-plus years, and our direct service providers who serve the DD community. And so we're hopeful that although that is not a solution and won't completely solve the problem, it'll begin to slowly move us down the path where we're investing in the infrastructure and that we're giving people the resources they need to actually provide the service. But I appreciate you bringing that up because it's a very, very real problem for us.
When you terminate a license of a provider, what happens to the funding that they were getting?
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, I want to be careful about how I answer that. And actually, the best answer is I'm not sure. But, you know, it really goes back into it just as part of the budget. And then we use it to fund other services in the same area.
Follow up. So then that money isn't reallocated to other providers? It's just left in a pot that you use at your discretion?
We have to go, Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, in order to increase rates for some of our providers, some of it is statutory, so the legislature actually has to approve a rate increase. Some of it is collectively bargained. And so we don't have a lot of areas where we can just go in and as a department unilaterally implement a rate increase. There are different processes that we have to go through to actually grant a rate increase.
One last follow-up. Could you, and it's not anything that has to happen overnight, but could you document the money that was removed? I mean, when you terminated a provider, could you document the money that you got back and where it went and what it did?
Chair Gelser and Vice Chair Olson, I can go back and talk to our people and see what we can provide.
Just to see if we know that trail is.
Yeah.
Because perhaps there could be legislation that would give you an arbitrary opportunity to reinvest those funds in other child care facilities so that they could come up a little bit.
Right.
Sure. Doesn't the funding, though, go based on a rate for the child? So wherever the child is, that rate is paid for the child. So it's not so much that we're allocating $10 to this agency for this program. We're allocating $2.50 or $4.50 depending on the assessed need of the kid. I mean, doesn't the money follow the kid more than that the money follows the program?
So Chair Gelser and Vice Chair Olson, that's I think some of the funding models and other people can speak more intelligently about this than I can, but with some providers it's by the bed, so we pay for a filled bed. For some providers, on the senior side, it's based on an hourly rate, and then we determine, based on the need of the client, how many hours that person's entitled to, how many hours of care. And so there are a variety of different models on how we pay providers.
So, and I just wanted to agree. I think we certainly have a funding and a rate issue and a wage issue to keep people in the system. I think we also have to be careful when we do a difficult thing. This culture change, and I think the biggest change that we've had isn't any legislation. It's what you've said. The department had the authority to do these things.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Senate Bill 1515, more than anything else, was an exclamation mark on the idea that the legislature expects the department to enforce the regulations that were already in place, because we did not create any new regulations.
Right.
We just said, department, we're going to hold you accountable if you don't do it. But the situations that are being responded to for kids are very, very real. And while there is an increased need for funding, I don't think that excuses the things that have happened. Sex having kids or adults, staff having sex with children to the point that children are born, physical abuse, suicides that are not just because it happened, but are a result of abuse that, you know, it would not have happened if people had,
right,
had provided care in an appropriate way and followed regulations. Those are very real impacts for kids, and I appreciate that there are challenges for providers, but as we go through the system, I was really compelled last week. We were at the Human Services Coalition. I think Dr. Richardson was there too, and the very real impact for kids, there was a young woman, 18 years old, came into care at 15, was at Give Us This Day twice, has been in more foster programs than she can keep track of, more caseworkers than she can keep track of. Right now, she doesn't even have a caseworker. She's got courtesy supervision from a supervisor. She's in care, but she's homeless. She's couch surfing. She has no place to sleep at nighttime. She doesn't have a CASA. She has a supervisor. So for her, it's not just an inconvenience and a professional frustration. She spent 3 years of her childhood being incredibly traumatized and unserved. And so as much as the inconvenience and the difficulty comes for the process and the providers and all of us, and I think we have to keep in mind at the end of the day, it's these individual kids. And you look at that CERT, where sometimes those decisions were made because it would be inconvenient for someone, it would hurt someone's feelings, or it would be too much of a licensing action. We now don't have that child with us anymore. And that's a collection of those decisions that put adults before kids. So I think we've got to fund, but we have to keep moving forward and recognize that culture change is disruptive. And I hope as we get through this end, we can all be very proud of a system that really does put kids first, even when it's hard for the adults in the process.
Yeah, you know, Chair Gelsler, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, so, you know, I think one of the really helpful things has been this whole safety and licensing review team process, because it really is a way for all parts of the organization to say, here's kind of where the lines are. Here's where we're going to draw the lines. And we have some consistency among programs. I will tell you that I attend all those meetings. And so we talk about who we're going to suspend or revoke or put conditions on. And I, in those meetings, have had a hand in making that decision. And when we've made them, I will stand by them.
Thank you. Any further? Thank you both very much. All right, we're now moving into adults, and we're going to loop back to kids again at the end. Is that what we decided, Clyde? Am I right? Okay. Just want to make sure. So we've got the Residential Facilities Ombudsman Program Update, Fred and Tony.
Good morning, Chair Gelsler. sit there a while and your mouth kind of freezes up. Chair Gelsler, members of the committee, Representative Stark, again, good morning. I'm Fred Steele. I'm the State Long-Term Care Ombudsman and Director of the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman. And appreciate the opportunity to come talk to you this morning, give an update primarily around the Residential Facility Ombudsman Program that has really started in the last couple of years as somewhat of a reminder, although I think you're all very well aware. For close to 30 years, the office had been just the Long-Term Care Ombudsman Office, primarily serving residents in APD-licensed care facilities. We now have, in the last couple of years, from legislative support for those vulnerable adults, we have a residential facility ombudsman serving in the same advocacy supports that we provide individuals with developmental disabilities, individuals with mental health diagnoses, living in residential facilities and homes around the state. We also have the state public guardian program that has been getting off the ground here in the last year and a half as well. So we have these three programs that are part of the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman. I want to just take a brief moment to update you a little bit on what's been going on with the Long-Term Care Ombudsman program in particular, and then spend most of our time talking about the Residential Facility Ombudsman program. Very happy that Toni Larson, and she'll be able to introduce herself here in a moment, is our state residential facilities ombudsman. She started about 2 weeks before I did in September 2015, has done an exceptional job in building that program and going live here in July, and she'll tell you more about that here in a moment. But with with our long-term care ombudsman program, what I wanted to provide was just maybe a couple of an update on what we've been seeing in this past year and in my year with the office, and to start with a reminder of, and I think most of you are aware, our program is built on a foundation of volunteers, community members, as generally is the case with volunteers, but community members serving and advocating for fellow community members. We have approximately 180 volunteers around the state currently, which feels like a robust number. But we have areas of the state where we need more volunteers. I want to take the opportunity to thank Senator Mona Sanderson for sending out an e-newsletter just yesterday recruiting more volunteers, where we have a significant gap in our volunteer corps in eastern Multnomah County, and particularly her district. We have a training that's scheduled to start celebrating Oregon's birthday, I'll say February 14th next year. So I very much appreciate that. Thank you. With the program and what we've been seeing out there, again, by way of an update, and I'll preface this with, again, many good facilities around the state. We have 510 assisted living residential care facilities, approximately 138 nursing facilities, over 1,500, and these are, again, APD licensed adult foster homes. So in total, and these are APD licensed buildings from, you know, Aging and People with Disabilities from DHS that licenses these buildings, over 44,000 Oregonians living in these buildings that the Long-Term Care Ombudsman Program provides advocacy for. Many of those wonderful buildings. However, obviously, there are needs to ensure the rights and dignity and the independence or safety with the umbrella of today's agenda for these individuals that our volunteers are on the ground in their weekly getting to know residents. With the 180 volunteers we have, they're assigned. We have definitive assignments to a little over half of those total buildings around the state, identifying issues to assist those residents, ones that maybe they're afraid to speak up, so we can be a voice for them, a trusted voice with those volunteers that are going in on a weekly basis. So some of the issues that we've been seeing, these are our top 10 or top five. I'll just, I don't want to go through the whole 10 list, but just to give you some numbers, something a little concrete to kind of hold on to. Since January of this year in 2016 up to today, so it's not a full year of numbers, primary complaints that we see, a lot of discharge and eviction. That is number one. We've had 264 complaints resulting in eviction. And this isn't just eviction from an apartment. This is somebody's home where they receive care or receive assistance with activities of daily living. It's a big deal. I mean, it's a very big deal for these individuals, these adults in these homes. Number two, at 210 complaints we've received so far around medication administration and problems and concerns with medication administration, and at a variety of levels of what those are. Number three, 168 complaints for proper care planning. And I'll say that feeds in a lot of times with the discharge eviction, and I'll give you a quick case example on that. Number four, 161 cases of food quality and choice. Sometimes that's dietary, sometimes it is just, why can't we have access to salt anymore? The, facility thinks that they're doing the right thing because the doctor says the person shouldn't have salt, but that's just a casual example, but it's a common example of if you were in your own home and the doctor said you can't have salt or you shouldn't have, you need a low-sodium diet, a lot of us are going to ignore that if we like salt. So that should be the same for residents. But then and then our fifth one is shortage of staff. And we had 126 complaints with that. And that's something we've been working with our volunteers in the last couple of years, even before I started, for us to start recognizing that, a lot of times there's an actual problem, but the underlying issue is shortage of staff. And so to highlight an example, and this has been going on in the last couple months with one of our volunteers working on a situation, it's in a memory care facility, just in a significant concern and shortage of staff. To one resident in particular, keeps seeing the resident every time he goes in weekly, parked kind of near a corner, just facing the wall. they're supposed to be providing activities for this individual, but there's just a shortage of staff. There's not enough staff to improve that quality of life issue. But then even just 2 weeks ago was in there, and he's seen similar concerns like this, but this is just an example. Feces on another resident, feces smeared in the room, again, memory care and some issues with bodily control, obviously. But he went in and tried to get assistance for the resident. It took a little while, 10, 15 minutes for somebody to respond to assist that resident and get the resident cleaned up. The room still needed to be cleaned. Well, little did the facility expect, but our dedicated volunteer went in another 2 hours later to check in, still covered in the room, still covered in feces. And it's just a shortage of staff issue. That's not an uncommon problem, despite all the great facilities out there. There's really a need for additional conversation with the legislature, with our partners, our stakeholders around workforce development, culture issues, and facilities. Really trying to work to move in a direction where we can have enough staff in these 636 buildings or 646 buildings that we have around the state. They need higher level of staff and higher quality staff. So it's a conversation we need to be having. I'm looking forward to being a part of that conversation. I have another example that I could give around discharge evictions, but I really want to get it turned over and get an update on our residential facility ombudsman program because, again, Tony is doing some exceptional work. And really what it comes down to are the residents, the individuals, the Oregonians that are living in these residential facilities and the need for advocacy that has been very evident just in 5 months that the program has been live. So with that, I'll stop and turn it over to Tony.
Thank you, Senator Gelser, and members of the committee. To introduce again, I'm Toni Larson, the Residential Facility Ombudsman for Oregon. I really appreciate the invitation to come today to share how far we've come and the issues that are presenting to individuals living in the homes that we cover. I do want to ask if the map arrived for your review and attachments. Thank you.
Thank you. She's passing it out to us now.
Thank you. The Residential Facility Ombudsman Program covers homes and facilities that are licensed or certified for intellectual and developmental disabilities, as well as those homes licensed or certified for mental health conditions. In total, as of today, that's about 2,124 homes in the state of Oregon combined. 220 of those are for mental health conditions. The remainder are for developmental disabilities. The map that I'm showing this morning represents the areas of the state where we have opened and where we have actually covered so far. And you'll notice that a good geographic portion of the eastern part of the state is covered. We made very specific efforts to open in eastern Oregon first for several reasons. It's traditionally one of the last areas to be served in a state for the rollout of any type of a program. And for this type of work, we need to have time to spend with people, to talk to them about the program, to go out, to get to know people in each individual house. And weather comes to play in that as well. As a result, we started opening the program on July 1st. It took us approximately till the first week of September to cover the eastern part of the state. You'll notice, though, percentage-wise, we have a very long way to go. We have just started the process of the most densely populated areas for those program types. So we support for intellectual and developmental disabilities the 24-hour residential homes, adult foster homes, children's homes as well for the foster arena and the 24-hour environment. For mental health, the residential treatment homes, facilities, and foster as well. When first charged with putting together a program of this type for outreach,
really what the statute did was expand the definition of what facilities were covered under the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman. I'll be the first to tell you that I reviewed the bill at the time. It went through, and the first concern was just how different those services are for people and the needs of those different populations are, and that an ombudsman service needed to look very, very different in order to meet the needs of those folks. One of the most striking differences that we've discovered in this rollout, if you look statistically at the long-term care program, you'll find that they have a much higher percentage of the individuals, the seniors themselves, calling in for assistance. And the most striking difference with developmental disabilities is that you will have higher percentage of staff, and as well as county staff members that are calling in, as well as loved ones. We have a higher percentage for those folks for nonverbal in those homes. And so in order to roll out a program and introduce it and really touch people to see what they need individually, what assistance they need, that's a knock on the door, and that's spending time in the house in order to get an introduction. We're very pleased with the homes that we were able to visit. We got to 100% of Eastern Oregon to each one of those homes. It took some work to go back for some individuals. Including Klamath, of the 160 some odd homes now that are covered in all those areas, we've had 59 open cases. We currently have 59 cases, 29 open currently for that. We're finding that our phone calls follow immediately our visit. If it doesn't happen on it, we've got people calling before deputies even come back. One of our first outreach efforts, I was really pleased to make it back to the office and actually catch the call from the individual that said, "I have a magnet and I have a poster and I need help." And that's an individual that we continue to assist through today. You'll see on the map as well that we've just started to open Benton County. That
nice county.
Yeah, it is a nice county. We have a few homes left in Klamath, and we usually do a kind of a second tour of the area to touch base with people. But we were prevented from doing so because of the weather, and so we shifted to Benton. And that very week, we had weather up here, so we've had kind of a slow start in Benton. But I think we've gotten to about 20 of the 60 some odd houses there for introduction. So what do we do? I mean, we get that question quite a bit. What's the difference between the ombudsman's office and licensing or case management or anybody else that's going in there? And while all those folks provide forms of advocacy, there isn't anybody else in the system that provides advocacy, especially, particularly on behalf of the individual and what their point of view is, regardless of what we think, regardless of what the system thinks, and to help them, to empower them, which is really the goal of the program. How do you empower first for somebody to be involved in that? Then secondly, if someone is not able of doing that, capable of doing that, how do we go in and help make happen on basic care needs and quality of life for what an individual needs? It's a partnership, and a lot of the discussions with the department, discussions with the individual providers, comes around being partners in doing that, that we each bring something to the table to resolve. It's very difficult to be your own advocate. It's a little bit easier to be somebody else's. And when you're someone who's depending on care, have either depended on care for the majority of your life or just started within the last couple of months, you're in a very precarious position. Will I make someone angry? Will they want to say goodnight to me tonight? Will I get my favorite English muffin in the morning? Because I may not. Your entire life is affected by that. If you have a loved one and you're calling about a loved one, your first thought in your mind is, if I bring this up, it seems very small, but am I putting in jeopardy the day-to-day care that my loved one is actually getting? So we've met a lot of great folks. We have encountered, we have been surprised at what we've encountered with people that we thought would be on the edge of arguments. Maybe I don't want to take my medication, and help me talk to folks about not doing that anymore. And frankly, staff, that was the most often brought up by staff, that they were worried we were going to come in and advocate to remove medications for everybody. What's disturbing is we haven't found that. What we found are some really basic day-to-day issues that affect people's lives. And I brought a list of those today of what we've been seeing. And, you know, where we think that we will continue to work and we'll continue to do outreach and make improvements for folks within the system. I'm very hopeful of that. Some of the cases coming right through this weekend in discussions that have been pretty disturbing for folks. Let's just start at the top of the list. Basic necessities not provided, no heat or water in the home. Rep payee not paying bills timely. Rep payee controlling the person beyond the authority. Illegal move out notice. What we found in, representing on this map, these are the areas that we've opened because we can control that with four deputies. That's all we've got. But we have been taking phone calls and will continue to from other parts of the state, wherever that's required. So some of these issues are coming from lots of different places. There's only been one county so far for mental health that's actually issuing a legal move-out notice for folks. So so far they haven't had the opportunity to respond or to grieve it or to say, how can I stay? Verbal and emotional abuse. Verbal abuse by staff, swearing, making fun of the person. Access to food, lack of choice. Limited variety available, limitations so that everybody's eating at the same time. Nutritional food not provided. We had one provider require an individual and then their guardian to go get a specific prescription from the physician so that they could have fresh food rather than getting food from the dollar store. Access to mental health services. This would be mental health.
Can I just clarify on that? They had to have a prescription from the doctor to eat food?
To have fresh food available and not food that was purchased from the prepackaged from the dollar store was the specific complaint. Access to their weekly mental health sessions or bi-weekly mental health sessions, which had to do with transportation. We've run into a lot of guardianship issues, whether those are relative guardians or other. Person not being allowed time in the community, person not allowed visitors, phone numbers from friends blocked, insisting the person can be seen or heard by staff at all times, removal of doors, removal of clothes, lack of privacy, lack of access to the community, isolation, blocking access to ombudsman services. Issues with access to dental care, which is what we're finding a lack of connection to the NCCs and other elements that people need to get their specialized equipment, with issues with prescriptions. We've had one person with a modified diet that we found with just wanted help, wanted to eat nachos again. And that's how the conversation opened. And as we spent time, we found that individual actually, due to abuse, was just where the dentures were broken and some eye issues. It had been several months, and that had not been followed up on. And they had a lack of connections to get to that stuff. We have reported abuse and neglect. We've had issues within that system in actually getting follow up and follow through on that. Facilities and homes in need of significant repairs. Hoarding. Mattresses in front yards. Wrapped chain fences at the front of properties. We've run across some interesting information on access to employment services, just because within developmental disabilities in particular, those services can cross over. So folks remaining with the same within the same provider and not really being able to get out, they're asking for different types of employment services. We've had one phone call from a tearful mom of a missing individual that walked away from a 24-hour facility 2 weeks later and was not getting any assistance in locating that individual. That individual was located by the family 6 weeks later. She is safe now and she is at home and no longer in services. We've had several cases, and this is around the state, of refusal to return from the hospital. Providers of at least three different types taking individuals to the hospital and not returning calls, not going back to pick up, not visiting. And so these have been contacts from discharge planners. I am happy to report on every one of those cases that we've been involved. They have returned home. Some of those have been citing home and community-based services issues with returning people home, to which we have replied, if that person has lived there since 1980, then you probably can do something with the stairs. You can construct something different so that that's not a safety issue for the individual. Understaffing underpins almost every one of these issues. When we visit homes, by statute, we're required not to make appointments. So folks do know in the outlying areas that we're in town, obviously, and we work around people's schedules. We work in the evenings, work on off times, because that's the best time to catch people if they're at work, to see them at the end of the day, or around the lunch hour. As we've approached many of the homes, you'll find one staff on. In one particular case, for a set of providers in an area, we'll go in to visit. There'll be one staff. There were seven people present, one person having some significant support issues at the time. The individual then made a phone call, and then a staff came driving up from another house. When we moved to the next house, mysteriously, that same staff drove up to the next house so that they could be the second person on staff. There were several individuals in that home that were one-on-one staff.
So when you, and I'm not meaning to rush you, I just know we're running out of time on the agenda item. When you receive these, what do you do with that information? Do you contact developmental disabilities? Do you call the abuse hotline? Do you call the police? What is the next step to get follow-up to remedy the situation?
Well, it depends on what the situation is. Obviously, the abuse standards are the abuse standards. So we would not pass go. We would call directly and call that into the abuse line. That would be at the local county first. We've had a couple instances where we didn't get the kind of follow-up that we thought should occur on some more significant cases. And so we have hopefully worked out a system now to where that's reported locally, but we would be copying the state office on that. One happened to be a fractured hip that had been there for a couple weeks on a couple visits that we had ended up seeing. And I will say that was unsubstantiated. So if it's abuse, it's automatically going to go there. For these other issues, it depends on what they are, because there's a lot of locations to help an individual fix things. It all depends on what they want to do. So you would try to fix it at the home first. I'll say for developmental disabilities in particular, as opposed to long-term care, you can usually have an administrator on site with long-term care to actually resolve, and you don't see that technically with developmental disabilities. It's with individual support plans. It can become part of a planning team process. It can become part of case management. So we usually will make contact if that's what the individual wants to do to help them do that. In the interest of time, I want to make sure that I get in the individual support plan process in particular for empowering an individual, because that's central for developmental disabilities. in the cases that we have had to support a person during an ISP process, they have been very well able to advocate for themselves. Really quite impressive. But what we found in those environments is that the provider has come in with five or more individuals as representation, and then you have the case manager. They can pretty much stack the room. And so the individual's voice, no matter what it is that they want, that's very difficult to stand up to. And these are some very basic needs, some restrictions that really never should have been occurring for individuals. So we're pretty sensitive to the fact that we need to actually get to those if that's what the person wants to do. We've had individuals that want to move that are not capable of moving. We have counties telling us that and asking us for assistance. My biggest concern is that we were staffed initially at five deputies and a part-time volunteer coordinator. It appears now that we will probably lose at least the one deputy and the volunteer coordinator. A program like this, to carry this many places, we can't physically travel to that many places. Now, we're to develop a certified ombudsman program, but you can imagine as well that to recruit and to train a certified ombudsman for developmental disabilities and mental health is quite different than a senior facility. So we are currently developing that and doing outreach. It will be slow. It will be methodical. It will be more of a mentor situation. We do have self-advocates interested in that. I'm very interested in expanding that for self-advocates. That will require some special supports for them as well. But within the program that we were charged to start, you really have four separate programs here. Developmental disabilities and mental health, two very different support needs and two very different systems in how you access and how you resolve issues for people. So those have to be developed simultaneously. Children is its own system unto itself, which has been referenced before. They go across systems. And so it's why we have left children for kind of the end of our rollout, because they have some very specific needs in getting across some complicated systems. They're about, for 24-hour services, 34 to 37 children's homes, and then for foster there's a little over 300.
So will you be represented on that children's cabinet that was discussed earlier in the day?
I have interest in it. That's the first time I've heard. We're happy to be doing the work that we're doing. It depends very much on quality control up front. And I'm a big advocate for there's a lot that we can do right now with not a lot of funding. And the first being the front door of licensure, and that people are prepared to provide the supports that they're required to support, that have the technical ability. It's amazing to me that in this state it costs just under $300 to become licensed to be a hairdresser, and to open up a home for developmental disabilities under five, it's $30. There's no cost to be endorsed. That's the same for the renewal two months later. That disparity to me suggests a big difference in priorities. So we are happy to continue our work. It will probably look very different than what was planned originally in order to get the outreach that we need. But it's imperative to actually spend the individual time with people to talk about what it is they want and what they need assistance with, that they really can't get at any other location.
Okay, any questions, quick questions for this panel? Thank you so much. And in all of these homes, will you also be visiting the stabilization and crisis unit homes, the state-operated group homes?
Yeah, let me make one more plug for that. they are licensed as a regular 24-hour facility. So I'll beg one more minute. The phone call that came in this weekend was from a family of an individual that's been supported by the children's waivers for some 7 years for some pretty significant needs. And the parents were put in the position to visit an ER. they shared with me their initial email on day 5 of the visit to ER. The individual spent 27 days not admitted in the ER because they could not get admitted to a program within developmental disability services. Now, I know from a past life that stabilization and crisis unit, a very aptly named program now, if it were allowed to function in that capacity rather than in the 24-hour licensure, you would have places for individuals to be able to pass in and out. Developmental disabilities in particular is a life. So you should be able to have a fluid movement between home to get some assistance out if there's a medication that needs to be managed, and back home again if that's what people want to do. There's no place to do that, and at 27 days they took the individual home. That's medications that don't have to happen. That's trauma that does not have to happen for both the individual and the family. So that would be my pitch for those particular groups.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you.
So, continuing with this very uplifting day, Ashley. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. I'm Ashley Carson Cottingham, the Director for Aging and People with Disabilities at DHS. I'm really pleased to be here to present to you this morning. At APD and DHS, we believe that Oregonians deserve to live in a safe environment free of abuse, neglect, and financial exploitation, and that every Oregonian has the right to live independently with dignity, choice, and self-determination. Oregon is faced with serving an ever-increasing number of older adults and people with disabilities who need high-quality services and supports. And we're also serving a lot more people with dementia and Alzheimer's disease. DHS is really prepared to rise to the challenge of serving this growing population and to meet everyone's needs to the best of our ability and within our scope as a state agency. This is our vision statement and our APD goals, Aging and People with Disabilities programmatic goals. Today I'll focus largely on our role as a licensing entity, and I'll just start by saying that APD can and must improve all of our aspects of our licensing and our adult protective services functions to better protect older adults and people with disabilities. Our providers in the aging and people with disabilities system are entrusted with caring for vulnerable people. Therefore, it's really important that providers are meeting the residents' needs with an emphasis on quality and safety for those individuals. It's our responsibility as a program to provide the oversight as the licensing entity. And I'd like to say that many of our providers, as Clyde mentioned, are doing an absolutely excellent job, the majority. And so the hard cases are the minority of cases, but we need to make sure that we are highlighting the wonderful things that are happening by the really great providers and bringing the rest of the providers that aren't doing as well up to that same standard so that all Oregonians are treated equally in long-term care. So this chart demonstrates the number of licensed settings that we have in the state. We have 137 nursing facilities, I think as Fred already mentioned, and we have the 518 assisted living and residential care facilities, and then 1,625 adult foster homes. There's been a lot of emphasis on memory care lately, and so I just want to demonstrate that we don't have a standalone licensure in Oregon for memory care facilities. We instead have an endorsement that goes on top of the underlying licensure. So we have 11 nursing facilities with that memory care endorsement. and 182 endorsed memory care in that other category. So to become a memory care endorsed facility, you it has a separate set of requirements in rule. And the residents generally will have a diagnosis of dementia or Alzheimer's. It's generally a locked facility with outdoor space that is also secure. And there are slightly higher training requirements for the direct care staff around and directed at dementia care. It also has a higher Medicaid reimbursement rate if you seek that endorsement. It's important to point out, though, that the literature tells us that it's likely that close to 70% of community-based care residents have moderate or severe dementia that are not living in the endorsed setting types. So we know that we have a lot of people with dementia in those other settings.
Excuse me, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. The difference between licensure and endorsement, what is the difference? Is there a functional difference, or is it a difference in process in getting that status?
Thank you, Chair Gelser, Senator Dembro. The licensure is the same. So you would be licensed as a residential care facility, and you'd have to meet all of the requirements to be licensed as that facility. And then to seek that endorsement, you have to kind of meet a higher level or a different set of rules to get that endorsement, which then makes you eligible for the higher reimbursement rate. And it's the things like the residents have a diagnosis, a clinical diagnosis of dementia or Alzheimer's, and then you have to have a locked facility,
space. I guess what I'm wondering is, are there some states that have a separate licensure for a memory care facility?
I do believe there are some states that have a separate licensure for memory care.
Okay.
And I'd be happy to look into that and bring back some different ideas.
Thank you.
Okay, great. So we have struggled, I think, as a program and agency. Clyde covered some of the things that we have changed. When I came into this role as the director, I recognize that we were not using our full authority under law and rule in the licensing arena. And so we've really changed the way that we approach licensure. We also had the ineffective communication that Director Psyche mentioned, where the licensing division wasn't always communicating as well as it could have with the Adult Protective Services workers and our OWAPI office. And then the program also wasn't communicating as well with those two entities. And so that created a lot of confusion and was ineffective for our program. Our staffing levels for the licensors responsible for going into these facilities to do relicensure has not kept pace with the growth of the long-term care industry. It's grown pretty significantly. And we do have struggles, as many state agencies do, with our data systems. Some are outdated, some are not operable at times. And then we also have problems in that we didn't set very strong standards about how the data was going to go into those systems. And so there's many problems to sort out, and we've begun to do that. What we're doing to address some of those right now is that we have integrated the licensing staff back into program. We have new leadership. Dr. Ann McQueen is the leader of that division of APD now. We are also issuing conditions on facilities much more quickly than we had in the past. So sometimes it would take a very long time from the moment that an adult protective services worker recognized a problem in the facility for then the report to be completed and sent to our licensing division. And sometimes there would be many months that would go by before we would take the licensing action based on that abuse that occurred months before. So we have tightened up those timelines, and we are communicating more effectively now. And a condition, I meant to explain, is a compliance tool, and that is something that we've used much more frequently in this last year. And it means that we can work with the facility to ensure that they bring on an RN consultant or they bring in a management company to help with operations. We can also restrict admissions into the facility while the facility is trying to get into compliance. Just quickly, I'll touch upon some of our work around dementia. These are projects that the department has funded to improve quality of care and life for residents with dementia and Alzheimer's. And I'd be happy to follow up on any detail around some of these projects at a later time. And then this is a list of the collaborative work that we have done to better serve people with dementia and Alzheimer's. And again, I can go into greater detail at a later time if you would like me to.
Thanks, Ashley.
We're continuously trying to define quality of care. And we found a definition in a professional journal that sort of talks about what does quality of care look like in long-term care. And these five domains are what stood out to us. And it's most clear that we fit in the regulatory performance category as a state agency. But I think we also have a role to play around some of those other domains. And that's where our work with the providers in collaboration with the providers becomes really important, because all of those things will help us to define quality of care moving forward. So to demonstrate through some data the action that we've taken recently in adult foster homes, we've been quite a bit more aggressive in putting conditions on facilities when we notice that they are not compliant. So we've gone up to 37 conditions in adult foster homes this year, and we've actually had to do immediate suspensions in 20 adult foster homes to date this year, which is a pretty dramatic increase from previous years. And we only want to do an immediate suspension when there are very serious safety, health, and welfare issues in an adult foster home. And we have worked to correct our process to make sure that there's a safe and thoughtful transition for the residents that would have to immediately leave their homes. And again, that's not something we want to have to do. We only do that when it's a very serious situation. In assisted living and residential care, we've also increased the number of conditions, that compliance tool, in the last year pretty dramatically. It's important to point out in this area, because this is where the bulk of the growth has occurred in licensed settings, that memory care communities, the endorsed memory care communities, make up about 34% of licensed community-based care, and that 55% of the conditions we've issued. So it's a disproportionate share that have conditions in place. So moving forward, we're working to implement our statewide centralized abuse management system. We are transferring a system from Colorado that's working well for them, and other states are also seeking that same system. This will be the first time that we can look across the state and know, I can know when I look into the system, what types of things are coming in our doors, what things are being screened in and screened out as far as abuse is concerned, and when I can expect abuse reports to be finalized, and really have some better metrics around our adult protective services work. And that system will also go across programs. So there's three or four different programs that'll be impacted by the implementation of that system. We're also rolling out Aspen to our adult foster home licensors, and that's a system that we've been able to use in other license settings for quite some time, but we still are behind the times in that we do the licensing for foster homes in the local office, and we have to do review of paper files to know what the compliance history of an adult foster home is. And that's very hard as a director of a program this size for me to not have the access to that information readily available. We're also doing the other things that you'll see. I won't read through those right now. I'll just end by saying that we really have to continue to overhaul the way that we function as an oversight entity to better protect Oregon's consumers of long-term care. State government, we're challenged with the impact of an aging population, and we, like everyone, face the budgetary and staffing challenges related to the growth of that population. And you know, Oregon, I think, has really always led the nation in coming up with innovative ways to have a long-term care system, a safe long-term care system that takes choice into account. And I'm confident we'll be able to continue to do that moving forward. Thank you. I look forward to your questions.
Thank you. Are there questions for Ashley from our giant committee?
Well, just a comment, Madam Chair. Again, I'm just so impressed with the number of foster care homes we have, in at least in my district. And
you have a lot in your district.
I do, and we still need more. It's just sort of fun to know where they are, and hopefully most of them are giving good care.
Thank you. Yes, I think that overwhelmingly many, it's such a wonderful model where people can live in a very home-like, small environment, and many of the providers are doing an excellent job.
And I just wanted to thank you for your leadership and your energy and the transparency. I think it's been really interesting. A lot of times in human service things, we talk in anecdote, and it's been helpful as things come up. I think you've done a really great job of sending the notices of when there is a condition. And it's helpful to see that before the provider calls, because then I know when it's in my district, I know I'm going to end up getting a call. And it's really helpful to have that information. And thank you for doing that. I imagine that takes a lot of extra time that you all don't necessarily have. That's there.
Thank you. Thanks, Chair Gelser. I have a fabulous team, and they work really hard, and they all really care about protecting Oregonians.
Thank you very much, Ashley. Thanks. Next up, we have Lilia. Welcome.
Good morning, Chair Gelser and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lilia Tennanty. I'm the director for the Office of Developmental Disability Services in the Department of Human Services. As you've heard today in many different presentations, safety is a very important issue across DHS and also within the Office of Developmental Disability Services. This issue is one that is always at the forefront and something we continue to work to do our best to improve our systems, our processes, as we move forward and work to support both children and adults living in homes with their families and in licensed settings throughout the state. Currently, we serve about 25,000 people in our system, and we've experienced a significant growth in the number of people we serve, children specifically, but also adults, over the course of the last about 3 years with implementation of the Community First Choice Option, or K Plan. I think that's important to note from a safety perspective, because what it has done is made services available to children who prior had to wait and weren't allowed to access services. And I say allowed, it was because of different Medicaid authorities. It wasn't because it was forbidden. We had different Medicaid authorities that we were using that required children to wait on waiting lists until they reached a crisis situation before they could receive any in-home services or supports. So with the advent of the K plan, many children now, thousands more children, are accessing in-home services, which, while we still definitely do have children who go into crisis, I would venture to state that by providing in-home supports, we're also reducing the overall number of those kids that may reach that crisis situation, because we're providing supports in the home before it gets to a crisis situation. So I think that that's an important component. I would also say, though, that with this, what's happened is our infrastructure for our system has been taxed and stretched in almost in every direction that you can imagine. We've added, if I recall the numbers that I've looked at recently and shared with legislators in different discussions, about 4,000 people to services over the course of 3 years. So if you think about the magnitude of that and the capacity that that requires for a system, that's pretty significant. Our biggest challenge right now in terms of health and safety and protecting the individuals that we are serving is our direct support professional or workforce issues. You heard themes of it throughout other presentations this morning. I would agree with statements that were made earlier that many of the quality of care issues that you find, many of the things that happen with a person in a licensed setting specifically, but also in in-home settings, can often be tied back to the fact that staff are overworked, are tired, may not be there just because we don't have the capacity, the agency doesn't have the capacity to hire enough staff to do the work. So this is one that has been, that we're looking at in partnership with our stakeholders, is how do we improve our workforce, how do we build an appropriate work career ladder, sometimes called the career lattice, how do we create an environment where direct support, providing direct support professional services is a valued position, a valued role in the community. We are grateful and thankful for the work that of the administration and the governor, including governor's request budget, a POP for $22.3 general fund $1 million that would help support provider agencies to help us address some of these issues. We're also working with providers on developing career paths using nationally recognized programs to certify employees and move them up in their professionalism as in their jobs. So I think from our perspective, this is one that it touches on many aspects of what you've heard today, but it is one that's critical to us. I'll speak specifically in the context of workforce challenges and provider agency expansion issues to the comments that have been made by several different presenters prior to me on capacity and people waiting to get into residential services in inappropriate settings or inappropriate placements. We are definitely struggling with having enough placement capacity for children with intellectual and developmental disabilities and for adults who are in crisis situations. We right now are on average have about 45 children in crisis throughout the state in at some point waiting to get into a residential placement. The stabilization.
And average is that on any given day?
Uh-huh. 45, yeah, about 45 children, give or take. But in general, when I check in and we get the information on how many kids that we're triaging throughout the state, it's about 45 children. Those children can come from any number of placement areas, other places. We definitely have had children who spend extended periods of time in hospitals because we don't have a placement for them. I know the stabilization and crisis unit was mentioned earlier. I would be glad to produce information on the stabilization crisis unit that shows that actually our homes for children there, we serve about 10 children at stabilization and crisis unit. They actually are doing a very good job in that setting of bringing children in and transitioning them out. The issue is the capacity, and it also is with our go-to agencies. Clyde mentioned, Director Psyche mentioned agencies that we go to help support people with significant needs that we consider good agencies. Over the course of the past, I would say, 6 to 9 months, it is getting more and more difficult for those agencies to be able to help in a situation where a child or an adult needs an immediate placement or needs a quick placement. And it's not because they can't do the work. It's not because they don't want to do it. It's because they can't find the staff to put in place to support the individual. So across the state right now, in many different areas, we're in a constant network, constant mode of trying to find and work out placements for children and adults in crisis. I got a report just a few days ago from our Region 1 area that speaks to an average of about 26 new people requesting placement assistance each month. About 60% of those are adults, 40% of those are children. in general, they predict, or looking at their data, that they're waiting at a minimum of 3 months, if not years, to find appropriate placement. And that isn't because we aren't trying. It isn't because we don't have providers that can do the work. It's because we're at a point where our capacity has really been stretched beyond ultimately what we should appropriately be able to handle on a daily basis. So I speak to that as kind of our most pressing issue around health and safety, and one that we are working very aggressively to address with all of our partners and stakeholders. I will also speak to some other pieces that we are working on related to our overall quality management approaches and work to improve safety and health for individuals that we support. We have a quality assurance unit that was developed about 2 years ago. The purpose of this unit is to go out and do on-site reviews of our community developmental disability programs and our brokerages. Unlike other areas of DHS, we don't have a large state field staff. We rely on partnerships with community developmental disability programs and brokerages to provide case management services for the folks in our system. We now have a unit that has completed its first 2 year cycle of reviews of all of those programs. As a result of that, we've issued findings and gotten corrective action plans, and the good news is that this will keep us on top of making sure that our partners in the case management community who we rely on for case management are performing their role effectively and helping us meet the assurances we need to meet in order to continue to get our federal funding. Along those lines, I'll also mention, because it was brought up earlier, and I think it's an important point that we need to really focus on. It's been a change within the developmental disability system over the past couple of years, especially with the implementation of the home and community-based settings regulations, that the person's individual support plan actually be coordinated and the responsibility of the case management entity. Prior to that, in a lot of cases, a provider agency would work on the ISP and submit it. Now we really look to our service coordinators for residential programs and our personal agents for in-home services to really coordinate development of that individual support plan. It is a shift in power. It is a shift in who's responsible for the document. And basically, as we continue to train in that area and strengthen the person-centered focus of the ISP process, it should also, our goal is ultimately to strengthen the role of the individual in the process and to address some of the power imbalance that we know exists, it has existed, and we're working to improve as we go forward. We've launched a joint committee. It's a really horrible acronym. It includes ODDS, OWAPI, and what our OLRO licensing group, so it used to be OOO, but we'll probably change the name. We've launched this group several months ago.
Like ooh?
Ooh, yes, that's actually what we were calling it when we realized maybe we needed to change the name of it.
Catchy.
The intent of this group is pretty serious. We meet on a regular basis, monthly basis, and then there are subgroups that meet as well, really looking at our incident report information that comes in, looking at the licensure activities that are occurring, looking at our complaint. We have a complaint, a process where people can reach ODDS directly, and we investigate issues and complaints. We look at all of those things for trends, for provider issues. Is there a particular provider that we're seeing a lot of complaints about or issues with? What do we need to do to address that? Do we need to send licensing out? Where are we in various stages of OWAPI investigations related to what's happening? We are just beginning that of really shoring that process up, and I view that as being a real strength for us as we go forward in identifying not only issues we might have with individual provider agencies, but also broader trends. Quality management isn't just about looking at one individual provider or one individual home. It's about collecting data, looking at trends, and recognizing where, as a state, we can step in with policy improvements, process improvements, to correct broader systems issues. And that's why, from my perspective, it's really important that we at the state level hear about all the things that are happening, coming in through all the different avenues. And so I'm excited to continue discussions that we started with the long-term care ombudsman office recently about how we find out about all the things that you heard about today. How do we gather that information, make sure that it's a part of our overall process and that we're acting effectively, not only in regards to individuals and the specific providers that might come to light, but is this a systemic issue? Are we seeing areas of the state where there are specific issues that we need to address across the board? I'll also shift into talking about the stabilization and crisis unit again, just from the standpoint of safety. We have had a very informative and eye-opening at times task force that was came about as a result of legislation passed last session. From my perspective, I've really appreciated it. It's been uncomfortable at times, being perfectly honest, but it has brought to light situations and issues and trends and perspectives on things that had we not had everyone in the room sitting around a table working on, I don't think we would have, I could have talked to each one of those groups individually, and I never would have seen what came out as a group discussion in that. So I think that that's very important. We have recommendations from a consultant, a human services consultant entity that we brought in on what we need to do to improve safety at SACU for staff and also for clients, recognizing that those two things are inextricably linked. If the clients are safe, if the clients feel like they're empowered, if they're getting their needs met, then they're less likely ultimately to create situations that cause harm to either themselves or staff. So that's an issue that we are taking very seriously. And at this point, we are reconvening the task force in 6 months to report out on the work that we're going to do with individual stakeholder groups, including individuals from SACU and family members, and working out where we're going to go from here. The last couple things I'll talk about, Ashley mentioned them, and I'll just note that we're a part of those efforts as well. We're excited about the centralized abuse management system implementation. Data has been an ongoing challenge in the DD system, and I'll just stop that sentence right there. And we're very excited about being able to participate in CAM and use that system as a way to gather incident information and abuse allegation information that allows us to do trend analysis and more effectively approach our role as oversight entities for health and safety. One other piece I'll mention, and it ties into the information we learned at the SACU task force and the things I've talked about in terms of the individual support plan and the HCBS regulations. We're at the very beginning stages of this, so some of the stakeholders in the room, this is going to be the first time they've heard about it, and I'd be glad to talk to them afterwards if they have any questions, but we're at the very beginning stages of looking at how we can establish for the state of Oregon something that I would call a human rights committee. That's usually what it's called in other systems I've worked in. Basically, this is a group of individuals who are invested in the health and welfare of individuals but don't have any specific interest in a particular case or a particular situation that come together to review if a person has a restriction in their behavior support plan, if a restriction is called for in an ISP. We mentioned the SALT example. Like you can't watch cable television. If there's something happening where, for whatever reason, a restriction is placed on an individual, this group, we're now with the ISP process and the HCBS regulations. Those are all being documented. We'll start being documented next year as part of the ISP process. Ultimately, we also want to bring in a group to really review those and question them. Is this appropriate? Have we tried all the other things possible before we got to this point? Now let's check back in at an appropriate time and see if the restriction is still appropriate. So that'll take a lot of work on the state's part and with our partners. We've reached out to the National Association of State DD Directors to collect information on other states and how they run these types of entities, and we're starting to gather information that we'll be glad to share with anyone who's interested about it as we move forward in this effort. So I think that at a very high level, those are the things that we're working on, and I'd be happy to take questions or comments at this point.
Are there any quick questions? Because we have one more panel to go.
I just want to thank Madam Chair, Lilia and Angela for coming out to a town hall on senior services. It was very well received and it was well attended. And it's a way of educating, you know, our seniors in particular, and we had quite a few seniors there. We'll need to do that for the Ombudsman program, too, at some point, so that they know what it's like, okay, or what it is. Thank you.
Just this for the future, it's too big a topic for today, but I would like to talk more about the workforce challenges, both in the, you know, training of the workforce, the generation of the workforce, the retention of the workforce.
Glad to do that. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
Last panel of the day, Dr. Richardson, Lena Alsaney, and Nicole Stapp. We should have brought extra candy or prizes for patients.
I went and got some.
But not for us.
You didn't bring any back?
I ate them on the way. Representative Stark said he was going to bring us all coffee, and so we're waiting.
To clarify, the email text I sent him says we all need espresso. It was a hint.
I think it would be illegal for Dr. Richardson to bring us espresso.
He bought it for the whole room.
Oh.
Good morning. Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Dr. Reginald Richardson. I'm the Deputy Director for DHS, responsible for centralized operations. With me today is our new Child Welfare Director, Lena Al-Husseini, who joined DHS about a month ago, and Nicole from Oregon Foster Youth Connections. I'm very happy to have my partners on my left and my right, and very excited to have Lena here, because I think the last time I was before the committee, I was in her shoes, and now not so much.
I know you're very sad about that transition.
Thank you, Senator. Safety is our top priority every day, and our actions are guided by a core belief that every child and youth deserves to grow up with safety and support to ensure their success as they move forward. I want to start by sharing a little bit of the work that we're doing at DHS, particularly around improvements around safety for children and other vulnerable populations. In terms of abuse investigations, I think the last time I was before the committee, we spoke about the assessment that we would be conducting with the Office of Adult Abuse Prevention and Investigations. We have begun that process. As you know, that office also has the responsibility and the authority to investigate allegations of abuse or neglect as it affects child caring agencies. We have hired a new director. Many of you will know Justin Hopkins, who joined us in October from the Oregon Health Authority. Justin has a deep familiarity with our investigations, licensing, and regulatory oversight functions because he worked with us in his previous role. He has extensive cross-agency experience and knowledge of our providers, and that has already turned out to be a great asset to us. As I mentioned, we are in the process of continuing to assess the functions of that office. Jason has just completed a functional assessment inventory for each of the units under the responsibility of OWAPI, when we're also in the process of reviewing the organizational structure of that office. Moving forward, our priorities in this area will be making sure that policies and procedures are clear across the program so that work is predictable and consistent. We want to make sure that we will establish internal quality assurance and quality improvement measures, that we do cross-training to ensure that our staff understand how their work impacts other sections of the department, and establishing clear goals for the investigation function. In addition, we're looking more closely and effectively working with our other partners within DHS, including licensing and our other sister agencies, including Oregon Health Authority, and that we're focusing on our investigations to ensure that we're able to determine when there are issues of safety and that we do it from a trauma-informed approach so that we can ensure that children ultimately are safe. One of the other areas I'd like to talk about briefly is our internal audits process. Over the past year or so, we've conducted three internal safety audits with a focus of supporting child caring agencies. And the focus of these audits have been primarily child welfare, the AWAPI unit, and our licensing and regulatory oversight functions. Through those audits, we've identified 54 communication and process gaps, including clarifying the roles and responsibilities for those units. We've addressed all but six communication gaps, and we're working to resolve those as we speak. We have a number of investigation units within the department. Oftentimes, very confusion as to which unit is doing what. And so we've brought in, through the director's office, a position we're calling the Chief of Investigations. The Chief of Investigations position began in October. We hired a highly qualified individual named Denson Chatfield to develop a department-wide quality assurance model for all protective services. He will be working with program leadership, coordinating efforts across our agency to improve safety outcomes for vulnerable children, older adults, and people with disabilities. The Chief of Investigation is completing an assessment and will produce an improvement plan, and we expect that some of these priorities might include creating a consistent investigations approach across the agency, improving and increasing training for investigators, including cross-training of investigators, to provide advanced skill training in topics such as interviewing, sensitivity, cultural issues, including bias, establishing operating principles for our investigators, and ensuring that we conduct investigations in ways that are trauma-informed. I'd like to talk a little bit now about two pieces of law that we are working to continue our implementation strategies around. First is House Bill 2856. You'll recall that this bill is aimed at to reduce administrative burden on providers. In partnership with OHA and legislative representatives, a steering committee was created, and this year focused on the behavioral rehabilitation service providers. Three work groups are underway under this particular activity. The work groups are working on, one, a uniform process for auditing, a uniform reporting of forms, and shared information procedures. The next piece of legislation that became law that we are working around implementation strategies, and that's 1515. As you know, the permanent rules for 1515 are posted on our website, and there's a period of time for public comment, and that last day to submit comments is December 21st. The rule changes have been pretty comprehensive. That the rules involve not only central units, including our background check, but also child welfare and central and shared services within DHS. We continue to work on our implementation of this particular law. We want to work on improving our communication. We have heard from our provider community that our communication and the directions in which we have given have often been misinterpretations of the law. You've heard previous panels allude to that. We have a group that has begun working on provider communications, particularly around what we expect in terms of reporting critical incident reports, abuse, where you report, how do you report. We've created a computer-based training program for all CCA staff. We will be going out to facilities to ensure that they are familiar with the reporting requirements. We're going to be creating quick reference guides on reporting requirements and what our investigation procedures are. We've heard a lot of concerns about when there's an investigation. They don't know what the process is, when you can expect to have interviews, when it should be over, and we want to make sure that we provide that information to folks. We'll be holding webinars for CCA leadership and offering in-person and on-site training to providers. With the time drawing very close, let me transition and just invite Lena to talk about child welfare, and I'll be happy to take any questions either now or after each person speaks, whatever your preference is.
Thank you. Chair Gelser, members of the committee, my name is Lena Al-Husseini. I'm the Director of Child Welfare, and I'm very honored to be here, and thank you for giving me this opportunity to serve Oregon's children and families. So my 30 days, I mean, I can summarize immersion in child welfare. So I'm I'm learning. I think I need 90 days to sort of get to grips with everything that's happening. But a lot of the work has been done before I joined. So I want to thank Dr. Richardson and Director Saki for all the work they've done to prepare for my arrival, because I think they've taken a lot off my plate, and I'm really grateful for them for that. My work is informed by the public knowledge, the governor's report. That's really helped me sort of understand where we've been and what the issues were. And I've been very pleasantly surprised by the work that we've done with the CFSR, I think that's the acronym, with our federal review for children and families. And the plans that we have going forward are really sound and well done. And I know we don't have much time because I have to read another three pages, but I'll just summarize. A lot of it is looking at our fidelity to the Oregon safety model, looking at our practice, building in quality reviews at every level, from central office to district to county to, you know, branch offices, and making sure everybody's on board with all these quality assurances and every, you know. And The situation as it is now, the system is really cumbersome from looking at it as oversight from your side of things and from my side to look at accountability, and cumbersome for the people in the field to really work with the system, and cumbersome for our children and our families to understand the system. It's fragmented. So looking at the lens from the grounds up and seeing how we can improve it to make it more streamlined and easy for people to navigate and understand. So not so much time is looked at navigating a system that might not be the most perfect system, to sort of really streamline and focus our effort on children's safety and figuring out where we can sort of look at the root causes of these issues and move forward. Some of the, I think, the strengths that I found, I've been really impressed with the executive team around me in child welfare. I have to tell you, they're really incredible, amazing, and committed people who are the first to tell you we have issues and are working on them. So I'm really happy with the team that I have. I think my long term is sort of to create a system, and I'm going to sort of, my analogy is almost like a system that has an immunity system, like a body, where people can self, you know, always look at what's happening, self-examine themselves, and if there's a problem somewhere, they, you know exactly where it is. So some is a body of work that functions going forward and is always looking at itself, where it's going along, assessing and moving forward. So that's my long-term goal, I hope. But we're looking at differential response. We're looking at centralizing the call-in office, the hotline, and looking at different sort of measures we can take. So I know I don't have much time, so I'm going to read what really essentially was done before me. But I want to highlight some of this work. So the changes at the local level, and I've mentioned some of it, is the structural changes, data collection, becoming data informed. And I'm going to add to that also a training on how we enter data and training how you can access and use data. I think there's a disconnect somewhere. Yes, we enter data, but sometimes we don't know where that data goes, and we don't know what it means, and we don't really use it as reports. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the addition of the intake nursing assessment program and some additional policy changes. The structural changes that have happened, and really thanks goes to people who preceded me, Dr. Richardson here.
And Lena, I hate to do this to you. We actually have to be on the floor at 11. Okay. So as you're kind of going through those
so
pieces.
So the healthcare, and I don't know if you're all familiar with intake nursing assessment program, which requires every child to be seen within 72 hours. That's a big improvement on what used to be the 30 days. We have staff for treatment services, new staff who are dedicated, foster care for new staff who supervise and oversee the functions of foster care, and policy changes where there's a mandatory assignment when a child has been reported four times or more. Moving forward, the program improvement plan, so I won't talk about that, but I'll just add that we are looking also at BRS, at really serving foster families and improving, really serving and adding community to the whole mix at every level. I come from a settlement house model, so I believe in community and I believe in inclusiveness. And thank you.
Thank you. And I'm sorry that I rushed you, because the nursing and the screening changes, those are a really big deal.
I know.
Really, and really big deal.
Dr. Richardson.
And thank you, Dr. Richardson.
And Director Saki.
All right. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Nicole, and I'm definitely appreciative to be here today. I'm here as a former foster youth, and I spent 11 years in Oregon's foster care system, and then at 18, remained a ward of the court, but I was living independently for 3 years. I joined the Oregon Foster Youth Connection when I was 15, which I think everyone in the room probably knows what it is, but it's former foster youth working to improve the system. And so I've been doing that for 9 years now, and as part of that, I've been asked to join you today to share the perspective of youth and foster care on safety. And so I'm going to be brief and try to just highlight possible changes and things that we've thought of that we think could help. So the first one is that it's always easy to use numbers. So in the public knowledge survey that was done during the external review, 83% of the youth that responded said that after reporting abuse, nothing happened. They never received a call or any kind of follow-up to let them know the result of that or the fact that they had even been heard. So I think that right there can tell us that if I'm that youth and I'm calling and no one's even telling me, hey, I heard that you called me or you reported this and following up, chances are I'm not feeling safe in the system. So we can just gather that. So my biggest suggestion would be that becomes practice. If you receive a call, whether the youth made it or not, but especially if the youth made it, you give them a call and you say, hey, you know, maybe this wasn't abuse, but we should talk about this, or this is a respect issue. Can we talk about this between you and your caseworker? And I think what's missing there, too, is the opportunity to maintain placement sometimes. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's the youth has this concern, and it just keeps going and going and going because no one intervenes, and then that placement blows up, and now they have to move. And so if we're going to value permanency, that is one way to build it, is to build those relationships. And I would just also say I think that overall as a system, the answer is move them or attempt to move them or, like, this is just how it is, let's deal with it, instead of problem solving and making improvements. And I know in my personal life, but also a lot of the other youth that I know that have spent time in care, we kind of lack problem solving skills, honestly. We'll have a best friend and then something happens and now we're no longer friends, or we'll have a really close relationship, whether it be romantic or not, and it's the best thing in the world, and then one thing happens and suddenly it's gone. And so there's a chance to help build those skills there and to build permanency. But I also think we need to keep in mind that typically youth in care have already come from a culture of secrecy. And so if they've found the courage to report something, we should be listening. And whether it's a small thing or a big thing, they need to know that we're hearing them. And I think the other thing to point out is that sometimes it's easier to tell someone a small thing and then you go and tell them the big thing. So this could be them seeing what's going to happen if they report a minor incident like a foster parent yelled at them. And then later, maybe they're going to reveal that more horrific abuse that's happening. But if we don't give them that opportunity, that can't happen. So one of my biggest suggestions is to follow up with them. And I think the other thing, I was going to share a little bit about my personal story, but I know that we're a little short on time. But I know when I was trying to, it's kind of unique. Usually you're not trying to be put into care, but I was. And what would happen is CPS would come out. They'd say, they'd take pictures of bruises, but maybe it wasn't enough, so I would go home. And the only thing that did was build my aunt's confidence. And I told her, oh, nothing's going to happen. And things continued and got worse. So not only are we seeing retaliation, but we're also not necessarily encouraging, but making that behavior okay. And so the vast majority of foster parents are definitely in this for all the right reasons, but there are those that aren't, or over time they become not so much. And so by not responding to those reports, we're really building confidence for those people. The other thing that I wanted to share is that I think we need to move to a system where we're tracking, whether it's founded or not founded, any reports that come in by foster home. And so I think maybe that was part of the review that came out, but if it wasn't before, it was just being tracked by that youth. And so I think it needs to be whether it's founded or not, because a lot of little calls here and there could point to a bigger issue, and it should raise a red flag. And maybe it's just a training thing. Maybe it's just, oh, you haven't dealt with this age group, let's train you. That way we can retain foster parents, youth are in a better environment, can maintain permanency, or we catch those things before the headlines. And so that's one thing I really want to advocate for. And just a concrete example of this happening is that when I was in high school, as often it happens, I had a friend and I convinced her parents to become my foster parents. So they got certified to be relative caretakers of me. And after moving in, I found out it was not at all what I thought, and they weren't who I thought they were. And I was actually emergency removed from that placement. So I haven't always been quite as outspoken as I am now, but I've always been fairly assertive. And so for me to have been emergency removed, I think says something. And then later, the foster home I was placed in after that, I got a foster sister who had two younger brothers who were autistic. And one day she asked my foster mom if she would take her over so that she could visit them at their foster home. And I went along for the ride. And to my horror, we pulled into that foster parent's house, my friends who had become foster parents. And so me, as a fairly assertive teenage girl, it was found unsafe for me to be there, yet we placed two autistic younger boys there. So that's just an example of why we need to be red flagging homes like that so it doesn't continue to happen. Because they didn't have founded abuse, but clearly there was an incident there or some kind of condition that made it unsafe. So those were my brief two suggestions. I'm encouraged, though, by the work that's being done and that the review happened, and it sounds like a lot of the work's already started. So I'm hopeful that we're ready to move in the direction of making it safer.
Thank you all so much. And many, many thanks to Dr. Richardson and to Clyde and to Lena and Janine and the whole team. There's just an extraordinary amount of work that's happening really, really quickly, and all the information. I think just to put on the record a question to follow up on later, in the reports that we got, kind of that central, all the notifications come in, they aren't abuse, but it's a whole series of incident reports around the use of restraint, where kids are ending up with compressed joints, rug burns, bloody noses, bruises all over their body. And I know that isn't technically abuse, but I still wonder what that does in terms of leading to safety, or your point of it gets called in and then nothing happens. Does that make it okay in that environment? And I think what particularly stuck out to me were the ones where while the kids are being put in 20-minute or 30-minute or two-hour holds by multiple adults, they're saying, I'm having a flashback to the time that I was raped. So I'm hopeful that as this information comes out, there might be an opportunity to look at some of these things that have become practice that maybe don't make a lot of sense, and a lens of safety that isn't just abuse. It's what is it that goes to wellness of a kid. But any other comments, questions? We're sorry to run off. The Senate is on the floor.
Madam Chair, I got a message asking for the members to get
to go away. Okay. So with that, thank you all so much. And many thanks to DHS. I know this was a lot of work to prepare for this hearing today. Yes. Yeah. So I'm going to close the information hearing. I'm going to close the work session. I'm going to adjourn the hearing. Session. I'm going to adjourn the hearing. I'm going to close the work.